is that dog?
I beeped. That was Judy.
Oh.
Judy doesn't bark.
I beeped. Okay. But, yeah, I'm on Skype, so I can walk around.
Okay, we're going to get started. Today is June 26, 2014. I'm Gary Corbett. We've assembled a panel of nine truly groundbreaking women pioneers of running. I had a unique view of the sport, being the son of Ted Corbett. For example, I was able to see the 1960 Olympic team train at Van Cortlandt Park before they went to Rome. I was at Randall's Island in 1964 to see the Olympic trials. I was at all eight of young John Kelly's national marathon championships at Yonkers. My comic books were The Long Distance Logs, published by Browning Ross. I learned about your accomplishments from The Long Distance Logs.
I didn't.
Starting with the February 1962 issue, that highlighted the Manchester race. And the picture, one of my favorite pictures, obviously, of all time, is seeing Chris, Julia, and Diane Lachesi running at the Manchester race in February 64.
That's Manchester, Connecticut.
Manchester, Connecticut, correct. February 64, 1964, a cover of Long Distance Log showing Mary Lepper and Lynn Carman. Who had run the Culver City Marathon. Cover of May 1966, seeing Roberta Bingay finishing the Boston Marathon. September 1968, long-distance cover, showing Sarah Mae Berman running a four-mile race in Clove Lake Park in Staten Island. And a February 1971 cover Long Distance Log showing Donna Gookin and Carolyn McDonald, who had just run the Mission Bay Marathon. My father's inability to throw out anything and his passing in 2007 left me with a running history museum of all sorts of running memorabilia. At this point, I issued a number of open letters challenging the leaders of long-distance running to make running history preservation a priority. My whole goal is I want to ensure that all the unsung heroes of our sport are always remembered. And we can accomplish this by documenting the history correctly, preserving this history for future generations, and disseminating it to interested parties. Today's panel is the second in a series of 10 calls that I'd like to do over the course of this year. The first I did in May with some of the pioneers in course measurement approaches, and the next one will be one with the early ultramarathoners from the New York area. That I hope to do in early July. We dedicate today's call to the memory of Lynn Carman, who I had hoped could have been on this call. Lynn and Bob Carman were one of the original running couples in the United States. They also were early pioneers in seeking accurate course measurement of road races with their measurement of the Culver City Marathon in 1965. And with the thought of Lynn and dedicating this call to her memory, I thought we'd start with Mary Lepper to just, reflections on your running career and also reflections on Lynn. So, Mary.
Yes?
Go ahead.
What's the question?
Well, just reflections on your running career, things that you would like to talk about, and also any memories of Lynn Carman.
Well, I certainly have a lot of memories of Lynn Carman. I mean, she was just a wonderful person and my best friend for several years. And without her, I wouldn't have trained for the marathon. I wouldn't have entered the marathon. She and her husband sort of were the nucleus of a group of runners in the San Bernardino, California area. At that time, they lived, moved to Santa Barbara later, but at that time, they, he taught, Bob taught at the junior college there in San Bernardino. And they had a nucleus of runners that trained almost every day, and we went out on the roads and ran 10, 15, 20 miles on the roads every weekend with the whole group. People who couldn't run would drive the vehicles, and we'd have, you know, support vehicles and drive and ride, run along through the orange groves and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it was just wonderful training. I mean, when Lynn and I went down to Culver City to run, we were ready. Lynn was having a bad day, unfortunately. That's really unfortunate that she was having a bad day, because she was the one who inspired me and allowed me to train and get ready for the race. And so her passing is
for a few minutes
is a heavy blow to me. Luckily, I was in California in December, and I was able to see her. She was not, really sick at that time, so I, you know, it was nice to be able to see her before she passed away. Okay, so anything else? Any other questions, whatever?
What year did you start, and how old were you?
I was 20, and that was in when I met the Carmens. That was 1962, and I trained with them for about a year before we did the marathon. Previous to that, though, I had been, there was one of the coaches, the male coaches at our high school, on a wild hair, just decided he was going to start a women's track team. And so he had us out there practicing, and at the time, you know, 800 yards was the farthest we could run. But he had everybody out there training, mostly sprinters. I'd run as, I couldn't keep up with the sprinters, and they couldn't keep up with me at the long, anything over 100 yards, and I would start pulling away. So the longer the race, the better. So when I met Carmen's, when I was went to the junior college, you know, that was a real good opportunity for me, because I like to run. I like to run long distances, but not particularly very fast.
Did you run any cross country?
Yes. when I was in the junior college, Bob Carmen was the coach that taught the class of cross country running, you know, for the men usually. But since he was, you know, a friend, and he was wanting to get women into the sport, I think I was the only one. Lynn and I would both run. We'd all both go out in the hills and run when the cross country team was training. But I actually took it for credit. I actually got credit for cross country.
Wow.
And you were still an amateur, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
This is Julia. Mary and I competed in an open cross-country race in 63. I have one question for you, Mary. It's just been extraordinary that there was no publicity, and you're finishing the Western Hemisphere Marathon, Culver City Marathon, in 1963, just dropped out of sight. Dave Davis finally did a book a year or two ago. Why do you think it disappeared so, or never appeared on the screen of the media?
I don't know. Maybe because I was too low-key about it. You know, I was kind of embarrassed because I finished and Lynn did not. And I did compete in a couple other marathons after that, but I didn't train seriously, because I went away to Northern California to go to college, and so I didn't have the Carmens. I didn't have that group to run with. So I just, you know, and Mm-hmm. One thing that was significant, I think, is that the marathon was not a recognized sport in the Olympics. And to mm-hmm. me, it just seemed like a dead-end thing, you know, what are you working for? You know, like, you know, even those of us who don't realistically have a chance to go into the Olympics, it's still something in your mind, you know, that there's that ultimate thing
goal
up there that you,
yeah, at that
that
time.
You, that's available to you. And it wasn't. You know, it was just like, you know, like, well, okay, when I went up to college in Davis, and I said, oh, you know, and I was running about 5 miles a day, and I was planning to still be competing and so forth. And I went into the coach of the men's track team, and I said, well, here I am, and I want to train with the team and so forth. I don't necessarily need credit, but I want to be included and go to the meets and stuff. And he just read me the Riot Act about women shouldn't be distracting the man and so forth. Yeah. And it was quite discouraging to me. I mean, I continued to run on my own, but it was just like, you know, not much motivation there.
Plus, the AAU was so opposed to women running any distances,
right.
They could disqualify you.
They were. This is Judy, and I remember having a conversation with Mickey Gorman once, because she ran lots of long, long distances, and she said there's two problems with it. We're out here on the West Coast. Nobody on the East Coast even knows we exist. And secondly, we all are brown-haired. They're never going to put a woman who's not blonde.
That's good for Doris.
that was what Mickey said.
So if we all looked like Maria Sharapova, we would have
gotten
a
lot more publicity. Yeah, that was good.
Other questions or comments from Mary?
No, I think, you know, I didn't think I would have anything to say, but I've just been running off at the mouth, so I'll be interested in hearing the other people.
This is Donna just mentioning to Mary that here in San Diego, we wouldn't dare publicize any women completing a race where the AAU was involved, because the rumor was that all the men could be disqualified
for life.
That wasn't in the men's AAU, and so it wasn't until later when Ken Forman got to be the long-distance women's running chairman that women were encouraged to run. Nell Jackson was the one that I had applied to, saying we wanted to have long-distance runs out here and be included, and she said, no, there's not enough women running 2 miles on the track. And so maybe you were caught up in that they didn't want to publicize that a woman had run in there.
Yeah, and
in 55, when I started running, Dolores Dwyer, she
who's
was in
speaking?
The
who is speaking?
Game.
Miss McKenzie.
Oh,
Miss
thank
McKenzie.
You.
And she said I should take fresh AAU meeting, which we did. And I ran from Queen's Building down to the old Woolworth Building, where I met Frances Krasupski. And she said no women will ever run any further than 220 yards. She was scared that they were going to get muscular and the rest of it, and have babies. And I said, what do you think of me? Am I muscular? I was wet, probably 101 pounds.
Wow.
So anyway, I was disgusted. I couldn't get anywhere with her. And after that, Dan Ferris said to me, if you keep it quiet and not solicit anybody to run for you, you can run at the Coonstand Park. I don't know what the men used to do in the middle of a track meet. I don't know. I think they went off and had tea in the middle. But I could run a quarter, but I wasn't allowed to solicit anybody to run with me. After that, I got browned off, and I started running into men's road races. When I think of long distance, I was going up to the half mile. I'd never run a 5K, only in England, and things like that. It was a whole new thing. So then I started writing on my T-shirts, you know. The first one was that I'm a recycled teenager and things like that. And then when I had my daughter, I ran around Washington, and I was never allowed to finish because Krasupski said she'd have me disqualified for life. But
That was their ultimate threat.
If I ran through a finish line, I would be disqualified for life. And I just loved running. I loved to run. And then I met Julia, and in that particular race, it was 129 men started, I think it was, and I finished 121st. And I was happy because we had to start a quarter of a mile behind the men. And Julia was there. We were arguing. Julia had a skirt on, and she finished through the finish line, but I was petrified they were going to disqualify me for life. And it wasn't until 1958, I think it was, when the team went to Russia. The Russians wanted to put the girls and the boys together, and the Americans wanted the girls and the boys separated. And there was a half mile, and Lillian Green represented New York PAL and ran the half mile in Russia. I couldn't even run in the race because I wasn't an American. And so that stood me there. In 1960, I became an American, and Louise Mead and I had a crush in the 880 yard. Before that, when running the nationals, I had to run separated from the American girls. I went through all these problems with, we had, three or four white girls on the team, and the rest of the girls were black. We couldn't get lodgings all the way wherever we went, because we didn't want to be separated. So I went all through that, and I was ground off. Now, Tina's probably about, 9 months old, in arms anyway, and we went to Mount Washington, and a fellow there started saying, women can't do this distance. I said, you want to take me on? I mean, 10 miles is a long way from me. But I ran up Mount Washington and made sure that I signed in at every stop.
And what year did you run up Mount Washington? This is Sarah May.
I think it was around about 59. Well, yeah, probably end of 59 or 60.
You and I went up, Chris.
And they gave me a certificate to say that I had run up Mount Washington. At that time, they had no record of any woman ever running up Mount Washington. I never saw the fellow face again. I never saw him at the end of the race or anything else. But I gave the baby over to my cousin, who was staying with me at the time. And it's been like this the whole time. Gordon used to get stamped on his entry blank, men only, men only, men only. And it was an argument every single time I went to run, because they accepted my entry being Chris. They thought it was Christopher. And it was a big pull. And I feel that this has just been one, it's only really come to me really how honored I was to be one of the first women ever. You have to remember, I'm talking about officials running a distance race. And I feel very honored to be one of the first Americans to do this, because I think we've come a long, long way in such a short time. And to get Roger Bannister running 4 minutes in 52, I don't know when he ran his first one. But and we've come so much further than the men have ever come, and I think that one day we really will be beating the men's times, and that I feel very certain of this. I think.
Do you remember your time at Mount Washington?
I really don't know. I was shocked that I was going to run it. I had a pair of shorts on. That's all I know. But I mean, I was just, if this fellow passed me, I don't know what I would have done. You know, but. I'm a very competitive type of person. I've never run the marathon because I don't think I could have really run to my fullest. I would have killed myself to do that speaking. It never came up to that. But that Gordon, my daughter, by the way, was the first female to run in any female races on an island. She used to have to run in men's races and boys' races at high school. And never got any credit for it. But our whole life has been running. My son now coaches and teaches in Great Neck. He was a runner. My youngest son was like a Roger Bannister. He was a beautiful runner. His name is Stuart, but he never liked running. He came back with worms and anything, frogs and that. And so with that, he, you know, he's a policeman now up in Kingston, and he still has to run. But it's a shame that he never went into more competition. But everybody know how I feel. I feel that we've come a long, long way. I'm very, very, very happy because even I coach PAL in New York and I teach the children all the things that were necessary to be a good athlete, shower after they run, exercise before they run. I've been very keen on this all my life. And Gordon and I have done everything together. And what can I tell you? Birthday today.
May I ask a question?
Anyway, that's how it is right now with me. And I hope one day to perform in the shot in the discus, because my left knee is very bad and I keep getting pains in my left calf. So hopefully I'll put the shot in the discus. I wish everybody good health and keep running. And Grace Butcher, I just want to thank her very much for the poem book. And one more thing. Gordon and I ran in 1960, and I did not make the Olympic team, as you know. And I ran the English clubs against the American clubs, and I ran a 2:07 on a cinder track.
Wow, boy.
Two officials, there were three officials. That was English clubs against the American clubs, Italian clubs.
Wow.
It's been a wonderful life for me, and I know that it can't go on forever. But anyway, God bless
Chris,
you all, and keep running.
Thanks, Chris. Chris, couple of things. First, we want to acknowledge that today would have been Gordon's 87th birthday.
Oh.
And I am wearing We Run for Gordon wristband that Tina sent me, and know that we you'll always be remembered, and you draw strength from all your memories
with
Gordon and your family.
When did Gordon die?
Last year. July 19th of last year.
Oh,
and his birthday was on the 26th of June.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Chris, to talk about the different running options you had in Europe in terms of the distances that women were able to run.
In Europe?
Yes.
I'm sorry, but...
Hold on. He wanted you to talk about the options of women that women had in Europe prior to 1967.
Oh, they ran the cross-country, which was 3 miles. They used to run the 2-mile road race. They ran the, not 1,500, 1 mile on the track, 880 yards on the track, quarter on the track, and all the other events underneath it. I was shocked when I came here and women were only running 220 yards. But that was how it was, and it's we've come so far. And I'm sorry to say it, Gary, but I think we're going to beat the men in no time.
Other questions for Chris? Comments?
I have one quick one. This is Julia.
Sure.
Chris told me a story that I think you would like to hear, that she, in fact, was crippled as a child. She was in the wartime bombing. They left and went to the country. And you had osteomyelitis.
Yes.
Tell them how you went from being a cripple to a runner.
Well, it's a bit long story. I'll try and shorten it. We were evacuated, and we went up to Yorkshire. And my father didn't like Yorkshire. He wanted to go home. So around 1943, we came back to London, and you had to have a card to come back into a bombing zone. And V2s and V1s were up, you know, playing up London and everything. And then after that, we gate crashed at a house and became, what do you call it, Tina?
Squatter.
Squatter, I'm sorry. You have to give, it goes out of my mind, some words. And so next thing, the police came and took my dad off, and we were all crying around my mum. Yeah, and I used to climb trees and do everything. My leg was just, I don't know what happened sort of thing. But It was bad, and I was still in the hospital, going to the hospital. And a lady, when they said we could stay in the house, they brought another family in and moved upstairs. And a lady called Anne Stone, who was very well known in Mitcham AC, asked my mum if she could work on my leg. I suppose she was a physiotherapist. Anyway, mum said, no, she goes to the hospital twice a week, she's fine. And I said, but mummy, I want to go. So the woman was just amazed how I could climb trees and everything with my legs.
Oh, boy.
I used to have a brace from the heel of my shoe up to my knee and around my waist. And anyway, after that, I persuaded my mother, and I used to go to Anne's house on Monday, Wednesdays and Fridays, and I worked on my leg the whole time. And then in 1947, probably 46 or 47, somewhere around about there I was running, but my leg still swung out the side. But I used to nearly cry when they used to say, you go first, Chris. And it used to aggravate me. I wanted to be with the rest of the girls, you know. Anyway, in the end, in 1949, by this time I was running with a nice gait in my feet and my leg was straight and everything. And everything I used to say was, Mum, Anne said, she said, will you shut up talking about this woman, Anne? Anyway, Anne was in the hospital, and I couldn't believe it. I had a letter because we had no telephones or televisions or anything like that. And the woman asked if I could represent England and go to Scotland. And I thought, me? I'm six in Surrey, and now they're asking me to go. I mean, it's like saying six in Nassau County asking you to represent America. You know, and I thought, somebody's pulling my leg here. Anyway, I went to visit Anne in hospital, and said, no, Mrs. Leslie is an official. So anyway, in the end, she called Mrs. Leslie, and she said, no, it's at Christmas time, the race was, and nobody wanted to spend Christmas holidays in a race in Scotland. Anyway, I went, and I got early Friday morning, I went up at the station, met everybody was saying, don't forget, you're running this race round. It didn't dawn on me that seemed, you know, not everybody knew Anne, you know. Anyway, on the train, everybody was talking about Anne, and I was happy. I could talk about Anne for a year, you know, and I would still say loads of things. She'd been in the Women's World Games of 1928, Anne had. Anyway, I got up to Scotland, and the race took off. It was a three-mile cross-country race. And I was running, and I just loved to run. It was just something in my blood. And I thought, God, this is a big race, and I was gradually building up. And all of a sudden, there was a big stream, and I went running through the stream up the other hill, round a turn, and then a lot of people on either side were clapping, and I was thought, God, those girls must have run fast. And when I finished, I had won. I was on cloud nine. I could not believe it.
Wow.
And anyway, I was going to drop my medal off to Anne on the way home, and I thought, oh, no, she'll be asleep. I want to see her. I don't want to give it to a nurse to give to her. And when I got home, my husband was there to tell me that Anne had passed away late Thursday night. And anyway, she took my medal to heaven with her because she deserves a place in heaven. And so that's why. How I got over my osteomyelitis, and I had been a half miler, and that's when I started running half miles, and it's been wonderful. It's been a wonderful life for me, especially with Gordon by my side. You know,
yeah.
It's been wonderful.
Thank you, Chris. In going through my father's papers, and organizing his letters, I came across 30 letters between my father and Grace Butcher, 18 that Grace had sent him and the remainder that he had sent to Grace. And I didn't know who Grace was.
Great letter writer.
Because we lived on the West Coast, yeah.
Grace, talk about your memories.
Oh, I want to say I was having a lot of trouble hearing Chris. Was anybody else having any problems?
Yeah, I was also. I didn't follow much at all.
Yeah.
I had a bad connection, but I can hear you.
You can hear me. Okay. Oh, I hardly know where to begin. I so enjoyed hearing from Gary and recalling that I had indeed written to his dad back in the early 60s for some advice. But I guess to go back, I started running track in 1949 with the famous or infamous, whatever you want to call it, Stella Walsh as my coach.
Oh, yes. I remember Stella.
She was my first ever track coach, and the first spikes I ever had on my feet belonged to Stella, who was an Olympic champion in 1932. And the first day of practice, she asked me, and my mother drove me all the way to Cleveland from out here in the country in the days before freeways and such. And the first day, Stella said, what events would you like to run? And I said, oh, the mile. Well,
yeah.
This was in 1949. And she said, well, girls don't do that.
Yeah.
That was a surprise. Because on my bedroom wall were pictures of all the great male milers. And I just thought that's what I would like to do. So she said, you have good long legs, you can be a hurdler. And because I'm so scrawny, no one had ever said the word good about my body or any parts of it. So good long legs, that was enough to make me a hurdler. I wasn't very good, although my first victory, my first championship was in the Junior Olympics in the city of Cleveland as a hurdler and a second in the Nationals that year. But that was 50-yard hurdles with, I think, three hurdles, as I recall. But I always thought if I could just run longer distances, I would be the best runner in the whole country. I just knew that somehow. And, of course, the argument was girls don't do that. But in 1956, there was a revolution in Hungary, and a lot of their wonderful people came to Cleveland, the big Hungarian center. And the city of Cleveland hired a man named Alex Ferenczi, who later was Sandy Knott and Madeline Manning's coach. And he was astounded to learn that we couldn't do that, as Chris was saying. We couldn't run farther than a 220, or you'd never have babies or something. And so Alex and I started a campaign in 1956 and 57 to get just the quarter mile and the half mile put on the women's program. And it was a terrible battle with the AAU.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the name Kazubski will come up over and over again.
Over and over.
One of Gary's questions was, who were your friends and who were your foes among officials? Well, he, as national chairwoman, seemed determined to put a ceiling on the sport as best she could. And, of course, eventually, after a long, long battle, I guess they saw the handwriting on the wall, and they gave us the 440 and 880. And
didn't you run a demonstration event, Sarah May?
Yes. In 1957, at the AAU Lake Erie District Championship, they allowed my coach and me to run a demonstration 880 to prove that a woman could do that. And Julius Painzisch, then my coach, ran the first lap with me, and then I continued on my own. And I think my time was 2:57. I survived, you know, I didn't die at the finish line or anything, and that was kind of the beginning of the longer runs for women. In 1958, they put the 880 in the first national indoor championships, the first time for that event. They called it a demonstration event, but they gave championship medals for it. And it was indoors at Akron at the Goodyear Gym. And one of the big headliners for that meet was, of all people, my old coach Stella Walsh, who had moved up to the 880 in hopes of making the Olympic team. And when I won the race, the headline said
58 made the team to Russia.
What's that?
Grace, in 1958, the team that went to Russia, Lillian Green, won the 880 yards. I think it must have been national in Morristown, Pennsylvania.
In the outdoors. That was the outdoor nationals.
That was the outdoors.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry.
This was February.
I've got two hearing aids, and it's still hard for me to hear.
Well, when I did win that 880 in 58...
In what time?
In the internationals. What?
What time?
The time. Gosh, I don't know. I don't recall. Maybe, I think 248, maybe, something like that.
Yeah.
And the headline said, Walsh finishes third.
Yep.
Oh, well.
He didn't put you
in. Nobody knew who I was, but everybody knew who she was. And then, of course, we went on from there. And I don't know, as far as proudest moments, well, Lillian Green's name keeps coming up, and I've lost touch with her. But in 1958, the Outdoor Nationals, long story, I didn't run well. I finished third, and yet they disqualified Lillian because her teammates had run out or had run alongside the track as she was finishing.
Oh,
she was coming down the straightaway. And my coach, I didn't see it, of course. I was in the race, but my coach filed a protest. And they gave me the second place medal, but they said, well, Lillian is faster, so although first and second were to make the team and she was disqualified, they put her on the team. So that was, I mean, I love Lillian, but that was a terrible disappointment for me. But the following year, in 1959, I did win the National Outdoor. And so, you know, proudest moments, Gary asked about, would certainly be marching into Franklin Field in Philadelphia for the U.S.-USSR meet.
Grace, you know, in those years before 1960, myself and a girl from Canada used to run individually. We weren't allowed to run in the open because we weren't American citizens. I don't know if everybody really realized this, but there used to be like three of us running on our own and didn't even count for anything.
There was a Canadian girl named Joanne Abbott who finished.
I don't remember her name, but I know she came from the south in England. I know I've run against her in England, but I don't know. It's gone out my head, the name, you know.
I didn't get in on some of the earlier casual conversation before we started recording, but I'm still running. I run every other day or so, a little long distance.
Is this Grace speaking?
This is Grace still, yes.
Okay.
I hear you're riding a horse.
Yes, I've gone back to my very earliest passion, which was horses, and for the last 8 years, I've been riding and training a wonderful quarter horse and working cows with him and doing obstacles and just enjoying that. But I still run because I hope to make it to 120, and I hope there will be an age group.
No, you're coming.
Rah, rah, rah.
We'll join you. The biggest age group right now, as you all probably know, in Masters Track is 100 to 104.
What?
But
if
I'm 120, I don't want to have to run against some 100-year-old.
Well, I hope you don't mind, but I'm going to live until I'm 120. Gordon always said we should be. So you have to go up to 125.
Oh, I can't make out what you're saying.
We always said that we're going to live to that. We always joked about it, living to 120, as long as we had all our faculties with us, you know.
Well, I don't know. So far, so good. You know, any arthritis I have is more in my hands or my neck or something, but my legs are scrawny, but they're still going. And,
terrific. I keep trying to walk and keep find a climb and everything else, but I don't know. I don't want to live that long anyway.
Joan, I wanted to know how old you are now, Grace.
I'm 80.
80.
Yay!
I turned 80 in January. Gary asked about role models, and some of you, Chris, you must remember, it was an English woman named Diane Leather.
Yeah.
Oh, I know. I ran against Diane Leather a lot in England.
And she was the first woman to run under 5 minutes for the mile.
Yes. Right.
She ran 4:59 in 1954. And then a year later ran 445. And I corresponded with her briefly. I'm looking at a picture of her right now in my scrapbook.
Is she still alive? Is she still alive?
I don't know. I should go online and see if I can find that out. I don't know.
She, one time she said to me, Chris, do me a favor. Don't run behind me. You make my stride so tiny. Because she was about 6 foot old.
And you were talking about... You were talking about Bob and Lynn Carman in my first scrapbook, which is yellow crumbling pages from starting in 1949. There's a newspaper picture from, York Dispatch. I guess that's Pennsylvania. And there's a scene of Bob and Lynn Carman and their 13-month-old daughter, Patty. And I have a picture, a photo, like a studio picture they sent me. Patty Lou Carman, age 2.
Oh, my God.
And the story, the article, it has several pictures that shows Bob winning something, and then the happy family is together. And then it ends with this. Mrs. Carman, incidentally, believed in physical fitness, too. Every morning at for 15 minutes over Pittsburgh streets. that was something.
That was news.
That was then. This is now, yeah.
Any questions for Grace? Any other questions?
This is Julia. I just want to add one thing. Grace modestly didn't mention that she was a motorcycle rider, racer, and columnist. As well
fantastic.
As the published poet.
Fantastic. I always admire women that pop into men's things and show them how to do it. This thrills me like I don't know what, you know, whatever it is.
This is Sarah May. Grace was the model that my husband held up to me when he started me on long-distance training. And we discussed how she had gotten a half mile included in the program and so on and so on, and that she was a poetess, and not poet, poetess. We found out as much as we could about her. She's in the middle of the country. We would never see her. And anyway, she was someone who was held up as a role model to me because there were no others that I knew of.
Well, when I was in England, Arthur Wynne was ambassador to Great Britain, and he used to train at Battersea Park. And the coach that I had, who was Reg Bale, which Anne's husband, I hate to say it, but he was only had sprints in his head. That's the only thing I think he knew how to train. And I was running at Battersea Park this time, and this fellow said to me, asked me my name. And I said, I said, what is my name? And he said, he's Arthur Wint. And I didn't know who Arthur Wint was, truthfully. And anyway, he said, I'd like to train for the half. And he told me, okay, first of all, you start running 5 intervals. That's fast one and a slow one. The track is only made for running, he used to tell me. So anyway, I said, five. I said, I've only done 200 and 300. And then next couple of weeks after that, by the way, the last one was nearly always my fastest one because I said, oh, thank God I'm finished, you know. He put it up to 10. I just didn't know what to do. And then he put it up to 15. And when he got to 20, I said, oh, you're ridiculous, Arthur, you know. And I've learned more about Arthur Winston then. So anyway, he was a Jamaican, by the way, who ran in the 52 Olympic Games. Anyway, I did the 20, and I couldn't believe my 20th one was as fast as my first one. So it goes to show 99% of runners need to have their brains examined.
Somebody's saying hello.
It's Grace.
Yeah,
okay.
Grace was off the line for a minute there. Grace, did you hear Sarah May Berman's comments about you?
No.
Larry always held you up to me when he was starting me on long distance training. He said, "You see, she's gotten a half mile recognized, and she's doing this and this and this, and she's a poetess." And
who said that, Sarah May?
This is Sarah May, and
who are you talking about?
My husband.
Okay.
He knew of her, and he could tell me that she was somebody that I should look up to because she was doing all of these things to help women run longer.
That's
well,
wonderful.
One thing I teach.
So, I don't know. I just kept on, and competed for about 65 years, actually. Right up
like me.
2008. I have a medal on my refrigerator here in the kitchen from a track meet in 2008, but that's when I got my horse, and so I kind of backed off for a while. And but I love Masters Track. I went to three world championships. Took a silver in, in 85, I forget whenever it was, up in Eugene, Oregon. That was one of the highlights of my life. But I do want to mention one thing. I don't use the word proud very often. I meant pride goeth before a fall and all that.
Yes.
But when the irony was, we were given the 440 and 880, 400, 800, and then we weren't allowed to run the mile, but we could run 2 miles cross-country. Now, where is the logic?
Oh, it had happened to you.
That wasn't right away.
You could run
that wasn't right away.
Hills. You could run in mud and snow and hills and heat, but you couldn't run a mile on the track. Oh, no.
Half and the quarter had to be part of the program because the half mile was going to be in the Olympics. In Rome.
Right,
however,
right.
The AAU, in their largesse, at their convention in 62, decided that women could run a mile and a quarter cross-country to prepare them for indoor track for the half.
This is true.
Except the rule book got misprinted. It got printed as a mile and a half. So those clubs that didn't go to the convention ran their girls a mile and a half. Those that knew that the rule book was in error ran their girls a mile and a quarter. And when nobody died or dropped important organs from running the extra quarter of a mile, they corrected that in the next program. And by the end of the 60s, women were allowed to run first a mile and a half, then 2 miles, and I think it was something around 1970 or 72 when they finally let women run 2.5 cross country. Of course, by that time, women were running marathons.
We were all running
marathons. Right. And any of you watched the Winter Olympics last time, didn't the fight for women's ski jumping sound familiar?
Yeah.
You know, they finally got that in the Olympics, and it just sounded like a deja vu experience with us.
Yes. Hey, I want to hear from Julia.
Julia.
Oh.
Okay. Want me to jump in?
Yes.
Julia.
This is Julia.
Jump in.
And you asked, what do we want to be remembered for? And obviously, I guess I would like to be remembered as the Rosa Park in 1961, who challenged the AAU, and after a year of sort of behind-the-scenes campaigning and realizing, as you guys have said, that Francis Kozubski and the AAU simply weren't going to allow anything longer. And I have something to say about what their motivation was in a moment. But we finally decided that I had to deliberately, openly challenge their rules and chose the Manchester Road Race for various reasons, which was just under 5 miles. But it was a highly publicized race. And we started well in advance so that it was public. The AAU had to make a ruling. They made the ruling that, you know, even the Olympians, Johnny Kelly and Gordon McKenzie, Chris's husband, would all be banned if the officials allowed women on the road. And what did happen was a six-week, what we'd say now is that it went viral, huge amount of publicity surrounding it. It was the loneliest period in my life. I had absolute strangers coming up and saying, you know, women don't run, what are you, and this kind of thing, and trying to prove you're another Babe Diedrichson. And I just, you know, I knew I just had to hold on and do it. And I, you know, I would get kooky requests from nudists in Finland wanting the outline of my bare feet and people in South Africa. It was a huge publicity burden, but the thought that George Terry, my coach, and I had, I came from Johnny Kelly's town, the marathoner, and I had always run from the age of five on. I'd run to school, I'd run many miles, and it was just my, it was the young colt in me that wanted to go run through the woods, mm-hmm. and I didn't know anything about rules and being forbidden and so on. So in that 1961 race, it was, you know, I had Life magazine following me around school and trying to follow me home, and Sports Illustrated and so on. But the upshot was that on race day, lo and behold, Chris McKenzie showed up. Yay, Chris! And she had in tow the cute as a button toddler, Tina, in a little peaked sweatsuit. And a third woman showed up, a 17-year-old girl from the high school who was a ballet dancer. And the media had already swung over to our side before the race, and the media just sort of played, had a wonderful time with this. Here was this petite, blonde-haired, blue-eyed mother with her cute-as-a-button toddler, this Smith College girl in her skirted gym suit, and a ballet dancer in white bloomers. And that's basically how we forced the AAU. You know, Chris had actually beat me in that race. She went off the road because of the trying not to get banned for life, which was the ban that they threatened. And and we all finished, and we all beat some of the men. But it was a huge thing. And
we started a quarter of a mile behind the men.
I'm sorry?
I said, that we started a quarter of a mile behind the men.
Yeah.
The men had gone
yeah.
And then we started.
Yeah. And then afterwards, I waited to see when the ban would happen, what would happen. And we waited 6 weeks,
yes.
And the AAU came back to us, and they had a compromise. And this explains the cross-country anomaly. The compromise they proposed was they would not ban me from sport and take away all my New England medals if I would promise to never embarrass them again by running on the road. And in return, they would begin the next month to allow cross-country for women. And Sarah Mae, that's why the mile and all that was out of order, because they tailored that agreement to that circumstance. My heroes. I wrote Chris McKenzie when I was a nobody.
You were about 18,
I'm sorry, Grace Butcher. And I said, my doctor says I can't run when I have my period. And she wrote back, basically, hogwash. I ran some of my best pages.
You know what? Even in England, when I was running and I had my period, I used to say to myself then, wow, I've got to train harder today because I've got that against me. And at 9 times out of 10, I do a better time when I had my period than any other time. Because I thought, oh, God, you know, all these people keep yelling at me. My father and my mother had never, and had never up to the day they died, ever watched me run. It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I wore shorts, by the way, and that was disgusting in those days. My sister was a dancer on the BBC, and my father wouldn't even talk to her because Bill had to hold her. Can you imagine that? A ballroom dancer not being held. But rules were so different in those days, you know. My father was disgusted about their trousers, and
I'm going to jump back in, Chris, if I may. This is Julia. I'm going to jump back in. I guess the other thing which I would like to be remembered for, is I feel like I'm the Forrest Gump of that early running movement because I first trained on the East Coast and then went out with Igloi for the 64 Olympic trials and trained 80 miles a week, track work, interval training, totally different from what I'd grown up with. And out there got to run against, Mary Leper. So I think I'm the only person who raced against everybody here except Arlene, and I did actually run Pikes Peak in 62, but by that time it was a tame little race where you only went up the hill and not down. And what I've done in the last 2 years since I've retired is to work on an article which I have sent to Gary and which I'm submitting for publication on that early period of running. And if I can, I want to mention one thing about Frances Kozubski. I think I finally understand why she was the bad guy. And, she was not a minor athlete. She competed at the national level for over 20 years. She had 9 national medals in discus and shot put, was it? And she was a very accomplished athlete. So why was she the person who said to Chris, women will never run 220, it makes them too muscular, can't have children? Why did she go up to Grace at the beginning of that exhibition 800 meter and say, one thing, be sure you don't sit down or fall down after the race? You know, why did she go to Billy Pat Daniels after she had a collision and fall in the Olympics and say, and be so solicitous that she'd gotten up and finished the race? I think it goes back to 1928, where for the first time, and this is the gist of my article, women were allowed to run in the Olympics. First time we were allowed on the track, the 100, the 800. Yeah. The reality, yeah. Both events went off beautifully. World records were set in both events. But in the United States and a bit in Britain, the press fabricated a totally different story. New York Times saying 6 out of 9 women collapsed, they had to be carried off, it was a gruesome sight, and they published pictures to go with it. And if any of you haven't read the book published in 2000 by Daniels and Tedler called A Proper Spectacle, they actually got hold of the original footage of the 800-meter final, and it was a total fabrication. One person tripped to the finish line and got up, end of story. There was no falling women in the 880. The pictures, they looked even further, and the pictures were not pictures of 880 runners. They were pictures of the sprint trials in the 100 meters. So it was a total photoshopping. And then I realized, I did a lot of reading about Frances Kozubski. I realized she ran her first national-level competition at the World's Fair in 1932. She was the generation, and many of our officials were, that had been fed this myth of the terrible, embarrassing collapse of these weak, fragile women who were sobbing all over. And they had to live with that shame. And I think there's a certain amount of, by God, because as I remember, Judy, didn't you tell me that Kozubski said to Dennis, you will never embarrass us this
again.
Way.
Yeah, Dennis approached her at an AAU, this is Judy, Dennis approached her at an AAU convention and said, we have all these fourth and fifth graders who are running 10 miles in practice. I know they can run farther in the half mile, and she just looked at him and said, we will never appear foolish. We do not want to appear foolish.
And I think that basically that false report was believed for 30 years and cast a shadow over Frances Kozubski. She could have been nicer. Grace, can I tell them my story about what she said about you? Never mind. Okay, forget it. Anyway, Kozubski was not a very... was our archenemy at the time.
Yes.
Anybody have any particular questions for me?
This is Grace. I would add that you were talking earlier, and Chris especially, about runners being banned and all that. When I, my coach and I, in about 1960 or so, were competing or were campaigning to get the mile, he and I were called to a meeting after hours at City Hall in Cleveland. He was not allowed to go into the room, and I faced a panel of Kazubski and other AAU officials and was told that if I didn't stop campaigning to get the mile, I would be disqualified for life from the AAU. And this was obviously the attempt of a washed-up half-miler, me, who couldn't win that anymore, so I needed a longer race so I could win it. And that was my other Kazubski story.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is Sarah May. I have a different angle, but when it's my turn, I'll tell you my other angle about this whole business.
Okay.
Yeah. Any last questions for Julia? Okay. Bobby?
Julia, how old are you now?
I am 71, almost 72.
Okay. And how old were you when you started running?
I was running many miles in the woods when I was 5 years old. But the state of Connecticut had zero for women in track. I had to list under a fictitious address in Rhode Island in order to get into the New England AAU. And I actually was semi-crippled with problems in high school and started running right after graduation. I hold one more distinction. In the 1960 Olympic trials, I had the least experience of anybody there. I had run my first 880 2 weeks before, and my plane caught fire on the way down. But, so that's me.
Bobby's turn?
Yep.
Bobby, where are you, Bobby?
Oh, hi. Hi, everybody.
Hi, Bobby.
I just wanted to say thank you to Gary for putting this together. It's absolutely brilliant and an essential thing to do, and I'm very honored to be part of this distinguished company, and I would love to get to know all of you individually much, much better. It's a constant source of sadness that so many of the early women runners I never made contact with. I wasn't even aware of their feats until many, many years later. And so, I just want to say hello, and it's wonderful to be with you right now. And
hello to you.
I guess to answer the first question, I guess what I probably will be known for is the first woman to ever run the Boston Marathon, which happened in 1966, and also the three-time winner of the Boston Marathon in 66, 67, and 68. Although, granted, this was before the women's marathon was officially sanctioned by the AAU. In fact, women were specifically not allowed to run in the Boston Marathon, which was then a male men's division race. And unlike you, who were also much a critical part of the sports world, I was totally outside of the world of athletics. I had absolutely no idea of sports, or I didn't know what the AAU was. I didn't know what the BAA was. I loved to run as a little kid. I just loved to run. I felt as though I were a bird in flight. And I started running when I could walk, and my mother was always trying to tell me to sit down and be a lady and don't run around. And of course, we had to wear little dresses and shoes and stuff. So I rebelled against all of that stereotype, and by the time I was an adolescent, I was a real rebel. I just was furious at this box that society put women in. You couldn't ever be who you were. You couldn't have a mind. You couldn't have a body. You couldn't be strong and fast. You couldn't be a doctor. You couldn't be a lawyer. You could raise 2.3 children and serve your husband and cook meals for the husband's boss You couldn't have a mortgage. You couldn't have a credit card. You couldn't, you know, I was absolutely furious at all this, and I didn't know what to do about it. It was a much bigger problem to me than just the running world, which I knew nothing about sports. I mean, I'd never even seen a track meet. And so, but I love to run, and I found comfort in running in the woods. I mean, I wanted to get away from society's constrictions. And since I loved to run and I loved animals and dogs and horses, I rode a lot when I was little, and we played horses as girls. We'd whinny and canter around, and I basically never stopped running. I never stopped running, and I run through the woods with my dogs, with the neighborhood dogs. I'd run and run, and then I'd flop down under a pine tree and look up at the sky, and I just gloried in being part of nature. It was a different view of women. I always rejected and still reject this whole idea of women as sex objects, women as clothes racks, women as models with, you know, skinny legs and looking suave and, you know, this that you know, wobbling around in high heels and pretending to be dumb to attract men, and all this makeup, wearing makeup. I revolted against that whole thing, and I wanted to live in a world where a woman could have a mind, and a woman could be fast and strong and smart and intelligent and could change the world. I wanted to make the world better. I wanted to challenge all these false beliefs that were just bombarding me and keeping us all captive. So I just kept running and running, I think, to get away from that society, that those social constrictions. I found a kind of freedom in running and an autonomy. You can run anywhere. You can go anywhere on foot. You're independent. It gave me a sense of freedom and independence and being close to nature. I love nature. I love the earth. I thought from the moment I was born, I thought, wow, what a gift just to be alive and to breathe the air and to see, to be able to see, to perceive, to hear, to be alive on this earth. And I just wanted to experience it in all its complexity and wonder. And so to me, the woods was this wondrous thing. It was like a spiritual experience for me, with running in the woods and seeing the trees grow and feeling the sun and knowing that this was a little planet somewhere in the middle of the solar system, in the middle of the galaxy. And this was, to me, something that inspired me, and I felt close to it all. And so so when I saw the Boston Marathon the first time in 1964, I just fell in love with it. I didn't even think of it as a sporting event. I thought of it as a celebration of life. Some guys get together and run from Hockington to Boston, but it was like an ultimate challenge. How could you run 26.2 miles without stopping? I mean, it just seemed amazing. It seemed something deep in human nature that had been lost in suburban society, with this deep connection with nature, our animal nature, this running long distance. It never occurred to me that there were no women in the race. It just didn't, you know, I just fell in love with it. I wasn't trying to make a statement. I hadn't even heard of any of the constrictions on women's running. But when I think back on it now, I think it was amazing to me that I followed my heart. I followed this inner love, even though it was way, way, way outside of society's norms. And my parents just did not approve of my running. I mean, what is she running in the woods with the dogs? What's wrong with our daughter? I mean, doesn't she know she's got to find a husband? I mean, what man is going to marry a woman who runs with a bunch of dogs? I mean, this, you know, send her to the psychiatrist, lock her up, there's something wrong with it. I mean,
Didn't you run from your home in Winchester to the Museum of Fine Arts?
Which is
about 9 miles.
Yeah, and then I'd run back in the evening, and so this was it. So I ran. So I didn't know how to train. I made a decision, some inner decision, although it was totally irrational. I was going to run. I was going to be part of that Boston Marathon. And as I say, to me, I didn't think of it as a sporting event. I had no idea it was a men's division race. I didn't even know what division races were. I just wanted to be part of that celebration of life. And so I started to run. No idea. I wore nurse's shoes, because of course, and I wore a tank top bathing suit in lieu of a jog bra. And I just started to run. I just did longer and longer distances, and my boyfriend would drop me off on his motorcycle, and I'd run home. And the bulk of my training was in the summer of 1964. I took a trip across the country. And again, this was unheard of for a woman to do alone, to take a trip in a Volkswagen camper across the country with my Malamute puppy. And at night, I slept outside under the stars. I'd been a camper. I went to horseback camp, so I knew how to camp. I loved sleeping outdoors and, you know, feeling that I was on the earth and there were stars above and the feel of the wind. And I felt free. I felt free in a way out there. Just, and I'd never seen it. I wanted to see what the world was. And I loved this country, and I loved the earth. And I just kept going further and further west and out across the plains. I'd run and run every day. I'd run and run. I'd spend most of the day running, and then I'd drive a few hundred miles, make camp, sleep out, get up the next day, get some breakfast at a coffee shop or a truck stop or something, and then run wherever I was. So I went, it took a month or so. I went across the country, ran up over the Continental Divide, through the Rockies. I was probably running, you know, I'd see a little mountain. I'd see a mountain, like a pale blue mountain in the distance, and I'd say, I'm going to see if I can run to the top of that mountain. And I'd spend all day running across the upland plains and up the mountain to get to the top of the mountain, and then I'd run back. And I went all the way to the Pacific Ocean, jumped into the ocean, and said, wow, I just went across the whole continent. And that was the way I trained for the marathon. And
that
then
was good.
I came back. I sprained my ankles. I couldn't run in 1965. I had 2 sprained ankles. I ran, so I had a whole another year to go. And during that year, I continued to train, and I commuted to the art school, Boston Museum of Fine Arts School in Boston. And I was also a student at Tufts, special student at Tufts School of Special Studies, studying physics, mathematics, all the things that weren't proper for women to study, because I really believe women have just as much intelligence as men, if not more so, and that women were excluded from the sciences, and it was just so I was studying things that only men were supposed to study, physics, but also biology, which, of course, it was okay for women to do biology. And I was curious about everything. I wanted to know about everything. I wanted to learn about everything. I wanted to know as much as I could. So I was doing all that and training. Then I married this guy, Will Bingay, and I had met him at Tufts, and we had run together. He was a cross-country runner, and I had run with him a bit. And so I married him and moved to San Diego, and I finished my training in San Diego, and then I ran into Bill Guggen. Hi, Donna.
Yes, I remember.
I met Bill and Donna out there in 1966, and they were the ones that told me that you actually have to apply to run the Boston Marathon. So I wrote dutifully to Will Cloney and asked for an application blank and told him I wanted to run the marathon. And he wrote back and he said, women are not physiologically able to run marathon distances.
Right.
That was the reality. And furthermore, they're not allowed to.
That was their reality.
That was a catch-22. How can you prove you can do something if you're not allowed to do it?
Right.
So I got this letter, and there it was again, this horrible prejudice against women. Like, they put you in a box, and you're in this little box, and you can't get out of it. You can't prove you can do these things. You can't, are not allowed to do the things that would enable you to get out of the box. So I said to myself, you're going to have to give up your dream, or... Then I suddenly saw I had a chance to change the way people thought about women. that if I could call into question this prejudice about women, that it would call into question all the other prejudices against women. If women can run 26.2 miles, which was thought impossible, what else can women do that was thought impossible? It was a crack in the armor. Maybe I can change things or start to change things. If I can just prove I can run this, it's just going to turn the whole world upside down on its head. And so I took a bus back to Boston. I arrived the day before the race. My parents thought I was absolutely nuts. My father actually thought I was delusional. He thought, oh, poor girl, she thinks she's going to run the marathon. You know, I was ready to be locked up in a mental institution. But he was very angry because he thought I would hurt myself or possibly kill myself by trying to do this stupid thing. But I convinced my mother, who was a frustrated housewife, who had seemed to me had spent her entire life trying to thwart me and to keep me down and keep me under control and make me into a young lady, as she would say. Finally, at last, I got through to her, and she actually drove me out to Hopkinton.
Hey.
It was the first time in my whole life I finally felt my mother, my own mother, was on my side.
Nice.
And we really bonded at that point, and it was just a wonderful turnaround for us as two women, you know.
I know,
and
we're going to have to end soon. This is Donna. I just want to speak up for the men that I know that they thought
Could I just finish my story? I still have a few minutes.
Oh, yeah, excuse me. Okay.
Yes, so we can talk later. You can ask me some questions. But So I got home. So then I was trying to figure out how do I get into the race, because I knew I was doing something that was illegal. I thought maybe I could get arrested. I didn't know. I thought the police might arrest me. The officials would throw me out. The other runners would throw me out. Maybe the crowds would be hostile because I was doing something that was way outside the social norm. And people can be hostile about that.
Yes, that's right.
So I finally dressed in my brother's Bermuda shorts, and I had a pair of new boy size 6 running shoes that Bill Gookin actually had suggested I get in San Diego. And I had a blue hooded sweatshirt covering my hair. And then my mother dropped me off in the outskirts of Hopkinton. I started to run, and I ran around Hopkinton. I saw where the guys were gathering in the pen, and I found a little hollow in as close to the start as I could get without being seen. I knew if I got in the pen, they'd see me and throw me out. And then I ran up and down probably 30 or 40 minutes to warm up after my 3,000-mile bus ride.
Oh.
And then I went back to my little hiding place, and the gun went off. The men started the race. I waited till about half the pack went by, and then I jumped in. And the men quickly realized I was a woman, and this was a pivotal moment because I thought, oh, gosh, they could easily shoulder me out. But luckily, the men were friendly and supportive. And when I said I wanted to take off my hood, I wanted to see, I was getting hot, but I was afraid if they saw I was a woman, they'd throw me out. And the men all said, we won't let them throw you out. It's a free road. These guys were great, which was my other purpose, was showing that men and women could do things together, that we didn't have to be trapped into these stereotypes, and that men and women, we didn't have to have this stupid war between the sexes going on. And if a woman does something that men respect, they will respect her. And vice versa, we can be friends and comrades. And so we did that. We ran all the way to Boston. And when I got to Wellesley, of course, the women went crazy. It was being broadcast. My run was being broadcast on a local radio station, and the reporters, Jerry Nason, had seen me at the beginning, and he was reporting my progress. And so everybody knew I was coming, and the women were waiting for me, and they were screaming and jumping up and down. And one woman was going, Ave Maria, Ave Maria. It was just, and then I went all the way to Boston, And I finished in about an hour and 20 minutes, they told me, and then later it was determined to be three hours and 21 minutes and 40 seconds. And the governor of Massachusetts came down to shake my hand at the end of the race. He also was from Winchester. And then the reporters rushed me off to the side and so forth. And the next day, it was front page headlines. It was not just on the sports page. It was front page headlines, you know, first gal to run marathon. And it went out all over the world. And it was just, it was really a pivotal event. It changed the way people thought about women. And there were still people who couldn't believe. And in fact, Ed Gookin, Bill's brother, I mean, he tells a story about that later, which I won't get into now. But there were still people who still couldn't believe. It was so unbelievable that a woman could do this. That the next year I came back. By then I was in the University of California. I was studying actually a pre-med curriculum with a math minor and studying philosophy and just, again, everything that I could get my hands on to learn, I wanted to learn. And I came back the next year in 1967 and the next year in 1968 and ran again and finished first among an increasing number of women. Every year there were more and more women. And, of course, in 1969, I didn't come back because I was applying to medical school, and that was when my friend Sarah May took over and became the women's winner for the next 3 years.
Yeah.
So that was more or less my little splash in the pond. And since then, I became a lawyer, and I practiced law, a lot of intellectual property law, and then I wound down my practice, and I got back into my artwork. I do sculpture, murals, paintings. And then I got into studying neuroscience, which was one of my loves. I had worked at MIT in neuroscience the whole time I was going to law school, but it was very hard for a woman to get into graduate school in the sciences. But then later, one of my friends came down with Lou Gehrig's disease, and I ran the marathon in 2001 to help raise money to support the lab that was doing research on Lou Gehrig's disease. Afterwards, I met the head of the lab, and we got talking, and I got intrigued by this disease, and I started to learn. So I got back into my biology again, started reading textbooks and articles and journal articles and everything I could get hands on, and I wrote him a 40-page paper on what I thought might be causing ALS and things, you know, experiments that I thought needed to be done and so forth. And make a long story short, he hired me to now I'm actually working in the field of neuroscience. So I'm working in neuroscience and I'm writing books on, well, partly autobiographical. I just self-published a book called Wind in the Fire, which is on Amazon, which is the story of running, training and running in 64 to 66. And I'm writing a sequel and a prequel to that. And I'm also writing two books. I've already written two books on economics, simplified, which I'm now in the process of re-editing and bringing up to date. And I belong to an environmental organization, and I just came back from a meeting at Yale. We're talking about the environment and the economic system and how it relates and what can be done and so forth. So I just...
Good for you.
I'm still running. I run an hour a day. An hour a day keeps the doctor away, and the days are too hot or too cold to go out. I run on my trampoline inside and I have a son who's at MIT. He's a postdoc at MIT and doing really well. And
we still have four more presentations.
Okay.
But Donna, you had one. You have a quick question or comment?
Oh, I was just going to say that on behalf of the men, I must say that a lot of them really thought that women shouldn't because it would be hard on them. And I remember when I passed a man in the Salt Lake City Marathon, and he said, "Oh, no, a woman's passing me." And I said, well, how many miles per week are you putting in? He said, 30 or 40. And I said, I'm putting over 60 a week and have been doing so. And then he seemed to have a little respect as he looked at me and could appreciate that I had worked out harder than he did. But really, at the beginning, I think men really were afraid that women would hurt themselves, and so they were torn between whether they should, whether they could, and whether they were going to get beaten at the end.
Bobby, if you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
Oh, you, Bobby?
Well, I tell everyone I'm 39 and holding.
Good.
Actually, I'll tell you, when I ran the 1966 marathon, I was 23, so you can figure it out.
Same age as some of us, yeah.
Her son is slightly over 30, so I would say that she's not 39 and holding.
And you should know because he lives in your house.
Yes, he does.
Oh,
tall, handsome fellow who's a postdoc in neuroscience at MIT.
This is Chris here. I'd like to tell you a little bit. When my godson used to say to me, how old are you, Grandma? How old are you? I used to say, 21 plus. Tina got to 55. And he said, how come my mum's 55 and you're still 21 plus?
Sarah May? Let's,
okay. I got into running at all because my husband had run in high school, which he graduated in 55, and college, which he was class of 55 at MIT. And both schools had excellent programs for all levels of physical activity. And we moved to Providence after we got married. I was still in my sophomore year at Rhode Island School of Design, and he didn't run for the first year, and then he said to me, I simply have to run. So he began to run, and he was commuting back to Boston to MIT, to his master's program, and then to his work at Instrumentation Lab. And he eventually entered me into a 50-yard handicap race at some local track meet in Providence. And I had the least experience, so I was given the most distance. So I managed in 50 yards with the most advantage to finish third. Sprinter, I am not. And eventually, he began to get me to run longer. Of course, in 58 and 59, I had children. And then our third was born in February of 63. But in between the second and third kids, I began, under his supervision, to do some more running. Because he said, if guys can run, why can't girls? And we had started our sports club, the Cambridge Sports Union, in 62. It started as a running club, the first male and female running club in New England. And eventually we added cross-country skiing, and eventually in the early 70s we added orienteering. And in each sport I found myself as a pioneer, encouraged by my husband. And my parents were wary. I was the oldest of their five kids. They were very wary. But Larry was an MIT graduate. He could do no wrong. Therefore,
right.
If he thought this was good for me, they wouldn't
good.
Say no. And he said to me, my husband, by the time you're 30, the physical conditioning you're in will determine your physical shape for the rest of your life. And at this point, I had two kids, and I wasn't in very good shape. And he said, are you happy with your physical shape? And of course, I was. So he began training me, and we would take the two little kids down to the MIT track and run intervals or distances around the track, and the kids were on one side. It was a cinder track, playing with the dirt and the cinders. And we could keep an eye on them, and they could always see us. And that's how my training began. Now, Larry was also coaching some of the young men in the club, and he studied all the well-known track coaches at the time, Van Aken from Germany,
yeah,
and Lydiard from New Zealand, and Kostel from the U.S., and he applied their lessons because to the young men, and I did whatever they did. And he had me running intervals, some 220s, some 440s, some half miles. He had me running longer distances. As I was training for very long distances, like road races, he would have me running a road race, let's say, on Saturday, and a long run of an hour and a half to 2 hours or more on Sundays. And in the summer before our third child, I had trained all spring to be good in the track meets in the summer, and then we discovered in June that I was pregnant again, and I didn't tell my parents. I didn't want them to worry, but I continued to run in track meets, and my quarter mile times improved over the whole summer, and eventually I just felt a little bit unbalanced and had to stop. But after our third child was born, within about 6 weeks, he began training me again. And in the meantime, the AAU convention had approved the a season of cross-country races for women. They called them women. They were teenage girls. Remember, this was long before Title IX. And most of the girls that were running, except for Tennessee A&I, were girls. They were high school age girls who
were younger,
independent clubs, because it was nothing for them at the high school. And we set up at a local woods near Fresh Pond in Cambridge, and we had a series of, I think, six races. And we presented a bunch of girls from the local track try this long mile and a quarter distance, because they were used to hundreds and 200s. And he assured them that he was going to handicap it, and the first three places would get trophies. He handicapped me so well that I never got more than third. And so all the girls went home with trophies. That was very good.
Oh, that is nice.
The first big breakthrough for me, and my experience was the same in this respect as Bobby's, was when I was trying to run 5 miles at under 8 minute pace, and I just couldn't do it. This was 64, and the first time I ran 5 miles in one piece at all was in the winter on an outdoor wooden track. But as the year went on, I began to try on the MIT track, once the snow was gone, to run better. And Larry would run, but he would pace me. And I just couldn't seem to get below 40 minutes. So he said, well, let's go in a road race. There'll be people all around you. The adrenaline will be up. And the runners all around you will pull you out of yourself, and you'll do better. What did he say, 40 minutes a mile better?
40 seconds.
40 seconds a mile better. So we showed up in Marlborough, Massachusetts in June at a 5 mile handicap race. I had a babysitter for my three kids, and I went into the YMCA with him so he could register. And the guys saw me wearing shorts and a singlet and running shoes. I had big feet, so I could fit into small men's running shoes. And they realized that I was going to run too, and they were wonderful. They were encouraging. When I got on the starting line, me, two little kids, and two old fellows, everyone was giving me, you know, a cheer. Hooray, I wish my girlfriend did it. I wish my wife did it.
Yeah.
And as the race went along and some of the faster runners began overtaking me, the guys were simply wonderful. Oh, you're looking good. Keep it up. Keep it up. They were so encouraging. And through the years, I broke 40 minutes. I ran 38:37. Through the years, I entered a variety of men's road races. I say I ran in a variety of men's road races. I never tried to officially enter them. I knew it was against the rules. I just wanted to run because it would be better for my training to be able to run in this group of runners, and I would presumably find runners who were running my pace or maybe a little faster that I could hang on to them. Remember, this is the middle 60s. There aren't any, or maybe one or two girls that I knew of, and they weren't very close, who would be running these races. So I would, the only way I could get training for long running at a good pace was to run in a men's road race, unofficially. And I did this throughout the 60s. Never had any trouble with the guys. They were always encouraging. In fact, what I found from long-distance runners is that they respect each other's training. You can't cover 5 miles or 10 miles or half marathons or whatever if you haven't put in the training. And if you could cover it and do it in a decent time, they respected the fact that you were training properly. And over the years, instead of being at the end of the race, I began to pull up into the middle. At one point, I think I was in the top third, but that must have been a very shallow field. And I wanted, at the same time that I was doing this running, I began doing cross-country skiing in the winter. We heard the Winter Olympics in 64, and there were no women cross-country skiers in the Olympics. And in that, from the U.S. There were no Olympic skiers in this race from the U.S. And Larry looked at me and he said, American women are softies, but you're not, because I've been training long at running, and I'd run the full season of cross-country we held in the fall. And so we began to try to learn cross-country skiing. And we didn't go to colleges in the North. I didn't go to prep schools in the North, so we sort of had to teach ourselves. It took us years, really, to learn the technique. But by 68, they had decided that they were going to have a junior women's national championships. Well, since I was the only woman competing who was not a junior, that was no hardship for most of the girls. Except for me, there was nothing to reach for. So I got permission from the organizers of this junior nationals in Montana to forerun. Now, if you know anything about cross-country skiing, you know that the forerunners break trail in some cases. At any rate, I ran, and in one of the races, I unofficially beat all the other women, some of whom came from northern Canada, and some of whom came from Alaska, who had snow since October, and I hadn't had snow until late November, early December. But I was on the first women's national cross-country ski team after the Olympics in the 68-69 period. And after that, some of the younger women, and there were two in their middle 20s who had hitched on to the competition, and they were getting more fit, and they could beat me on fitness, and I couldn't beat them on technique. So that was the only year I was on the national team. But the same problem about women in long ski races, the problem was the same in women's long ski races as it was in women's long running races. There was a 50-kilometer national championship for men. And in 1970, my winter training was over near the beginning of February, because there had been a team trials to go on a overseas trip, and I was fifth instead of third, and at my age they weren't going to take me. So I began to train for running, but there had been a national championship at 50K for the men in Arizona, but it got to be 60 degrees, and they decided that it would be unkind to make the men ski slogging around the 50 kilometers in wet snow. So they postponed that event until
the end of February, and they had it at Putney School in Vermont. And I entered. And like Bobby Gibb, I was told that it was a men's championship, not women were not allowed, but that
yes.
I could enter into the college men's event, which was half the distance. And so I said to John Caldwell, who's known as the father of cross-country skiing, I said, are you going to stand in the track and stop me? And he said no. And so I finished in what I consider to be a very relatively good time. I beat half a dozen men. In fact, it was a looped course, and my last loop was faster even than my husband's, he figured out. Women were having the same trouble long skiing as they were long running. Now, I want to say one thing about the why women had such trouble getting approval for longer races than a sprint. I believe that it was political. Now, maybe Francis Kozubski was sort of playing defense and not wanting the girls to be subjected to any difficult media if they ran long. But I believe it was political.
Mm-hmm.
Larry and I went to two different AAU conventions in 65 in Washington, D.C., and in 66 in Oahu. And we wanted to press for not championships, but just to allow women to run on the track 2 miles. And in Washington, a pediatrician named Gabe Merkin, who was well-versed in women's physiology, came to present his medical information to them about studies that had been done in Europe about women running longer and how it was beneficial to them, not harmful to them. They didn't want to hear him. When we went to Hawaii, we figured, well, it's so far away, maybe some of the people who are objecting won't be there. Big mistake.
Right.
The very people who were objecting were there because they were officials and would get their way paid. And in fact, having gone there and hired a babysitter at the hotel for our three kids and made all this effort to go there, they weren't going to let us talk at first, not even speak. And finally, one of the vice presidents, I forget her name, I think it was Rosa something, said, let them speak. So we spoke, and they turned us down, and that was it. And that was 66. It was very disappointing, and so we had to set our sights on other things, and we set our sights on doing well at cross-country skiing and doing well at long-distance running. I continued to run in men's road races. I continued to ski in cross-country ski races. There weren't that many women there, but the organizers would put me in the junior boys' race if they didn't have a women's race. And it went on like that, and the political side of it was that if the AAU recognized women's long-distance running at anything longer than the sprints, they would also have to take under their wing the coaches of the women's long-distance runners. And that meant a turf war between those coaches that coached sprints and those coaches that coached longer distance. And the coaches that were recognized were coaches whose sprint girls did well. They got blue blazers. They could go to the big meets. They could get trips abroad. And they would have to share all of this with these, pardon me, Joni-come-lately coaches who were coaching long-distance women. And we heard all the arguments about you're only wanting to run long distance because you can't run fast enough to do well at the sprints. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, they never said that to the guys. They never said that to the guys. And I wanted to mention one other thing. There was a coach on the West Coast. He was Marie Mulder's coach, among other things. I don't, maybe he was Doris's coach, Will Stevens. And he said something that impressed us mightily, and we used it whenever we trained girls. Under every curve, there's a muscle, and you get muscles from training. And if you want curves, you train, so you have muscles to underpin those curves.
Right.
That was something that we
said that.
That we thought was very important. And what was my best accomplishment? Well, I ran a 305.07 in 1970 at Boston. And in the Roadrunners Club National Championships in Atlantic City, I ran a 307. And I beat Nina Cusick, who ran a 314. That was one of my prouder accomplishments because she was in, she didn't have a knee injury and she was in good shape. In 71, in end of May, I guess, Larry and I ran in what was called the Plotters Marathon in a town south of Boston. And it was called Plotters because it was for runners who hadn't broken 3 hours, and I was going to try to break 3 hours. So I ran with Larry. It was a little bit warm, a little bit muggy, and I ran a 3:00:35. Couldn't quite break it. Ted Corbett ran that same race and set a new age group record. I think it was an over 50 age group record. Later on, there was some question about whether the course was full length. Well, we know the guy who certified the course, Graham Parnell. He was head of the Spartan AC and Alberto Salazar's coach. And we felt that there had been some misdirection of runners at near the third of the race.
Oh, yeah.
And we believed him. And there is still some question in some people's minds, but I believe that it was the correct distance.
Right. And good for you.
Let's see. In the fall, I ran another marathon. Well, I ran the New York City Marathon in the fall when it was still running around Central Park, and I was third in like 3:08. And then later in the fall, I ran another marathon, the Bay State Marathon in Framingham, and I was trying again to break 3 hours. It was a coolish day, and I was 3:04:41 or something, and I was very disappointed. Later on, years later, we found out that the course was half a mile long, which was slightly disappointing.
Thanks, Sarah May. We should move on. If there are questions.
Larry trained me. He had me doing intervals. He had me doing long distance. He had me doing cross country. If we were going to train for the roads, he trained me on the grass, because then when you got on the road, your legs felt springy. In the early 70s, I began orienteering, which is a sport where you navigate with a contour map and a compass, and you find checkpoints along the map, and there's also cross-country ski orienteering. And I was on U.S. teams through the 80s and into the 90s because I knew how to cross-country ski and I knew how to navigate, and there weren't too many people in this country who did the same things. So
I think there should be more people.
We should move on.
I'm into three sports. I don't
Sarah,
run anymore because
Gary?
Of my knee problems.
Sarah.
Yeah, Sarah,
I keep asking.
Gary wants to think he can hear.
Now, do you have any questions?
Well, I have one comment. Sarah and Larry were early course measurers. The whole certification of courses was in its infancy in the mid-60s, and both Sarah and Larry were part of the early course measurers.
We certified in 1967 with John Boris the Boston Marathon course because it was going to be a Pan Am Trials event. Olympic Trials event. And it needed to be certified, and it wasn't. And the BAA, we didn't think, was about to do anything, so we certified it.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Sarah. 10-minute time limit went out the window a long time ago.
Yeah, we noticed that.
And,
By the way,
it's hard with these great stories, but
I have a chart from the 1974 BAA marathon because there were 42 women entered, and I got Jock Semple to let me look at their entries. So I have their names, their best times, where they lived, what their club was, and what their occupation was. For all of the, I have that information from most of the 42 people. And Judy Eikenberry didn't run, and I didn't know why, but she didn't.
Because we couldn't afford to fly all the way back to Boston.
Okay.
I didn't either, same reason, and I had three little children.
I had three little kids, and I had, my husband was teaching at State College. Didn't make enough money.
Okay, well,
because
your name was one of the names on here.
Oh, wow, yeah, because I had one of the
names. I can make a copy of this and send it to you, Gary, so you'll see all.
And I was invited the first year that they invited women, and I wasn't able to go.
Who is that?
Is that Donna Gookin.
Oh, Donna. Hi, Donna.
The first year that they actually invited women to come, and I was invited, and I couldn't go because we couldn't afford it, and we had three little children.
It was expensive. Yeah.
Yes, it was.
Let's move on. I remember seeing Doris Brown battling Madeline Manning in some epic 880s, but I had no idea that, Doris, your running career went back to the 1960 Olympic trials. Doris, why don't you talk a little about your memories?
Okay. My name's Doris Brown Heritage, and I guess so much of what's been said is kind of where my heart was and where my time and where my legs were. Like a couple other women here, I started out running about the time I could walk, and the neighbors told my parents to put me on a leash.
How old are you now?
I'm going to be 72 in September.
Okay. I'm 78.
But, you know, I'm from out here in the Northwest, out in the Wild West, and so for most of my life I didn't really know that track existed or that any of you people have the same heart and the same emotions and the same enjoyment of the environment. So I was out here enjoying the outdoors on my own, and I think that for some reason we just didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what was going on in the world of sport. So I didn't really have any early people who were, you know, that impressive to me. It wasn't until I got into the sport, until I started reading books and things when I was in college about really how to train or, you know, who the leaders were. I guess when I started running and got to the World Cross Country Championships, there are a couple of people who were impressive to me, but of course they were all men. But going back to the early years, I didn't know that there was running. And so I just ran because I loved it. I probably trained like a marathon runner, but there wasn't anything even in high school for girls. Girls were not allowed on the track.
That's right.
So one time when I was in high school, I was allowed to ride on the bus to the boys' high school meet and watch them run. That was kind of the extent of my high school running, the racing. But I worked on a playground one summer, and we took the kids to a little meet in Tacoma, and I was young enough to be in the meet. And the races were 50 yards and 75 yards, and there was a long jump. And I picked the long jump because you could run as far as you wanted before you jumped. And I did pretty well in that. And there was a man there who had some neighborhood girls, and he felt like girls should have a club. So he asked me to join the club. And, of course, my folks were horrified. They didn't want me doing that. I was too much of a tomboy already. But eventually they let me join it. And we didn't really train. We got together on Sunday after church, and the javelin thrower threw, and the sprinters sprinted, and I long jumped. And then when they were all done, I ran a 400 as hard as I could. That was the extent of working out. But I really liked to run, so I continued doing my morning runs after I fed the chickens on the beach and in the woods. And then I would run a quarter mile down the road as hard as I could, and when I recovered from feeling sick, I ran back home again. Finally, my mom took me to the doctor to find out why I was feeling so sick after this, and he said, "Well, do you warm up?" I said, "What's that?" So that helped a little. So then a year later, it was 1960, and by then, in a couple of little track meets,
We were able to go to Canada. My first track meet was actually in Canada because, you know, we're only a couple hours in Canada here, hour and a half. And they had better programs for women. So I was long jumping at the time, but I also ran the 400. And at home, I'm still running 10 miles, 15 miles a day in the woods and on the beach. So my first 800, I ran 219. And that was a good time. That was maybe even a national record. But there weren't really very good records in 1960, so who would know? But we did get the money together. Somebody in our community raised the money, and we went down to Texas on a train and ran in the Nationals and the Olympic Trials. At the Nationals,
what year was that?
I remember...
1960 Olympics.
There were a lot of things there that were unpleasant. One of them was I found out about segregation, and many of us also got takeout food and ate outside because if the girls couldn't go, black girls couldn't go in the restaurants, we weren't going in either.
Yes.
So this was a real good learning experience for me, and that's where I met Grace and Chris and a couple other people on this list.
And me and Ruth Ann.
And me.
And Ruth Ann Brand, yes. Uh-huh. And we all communicated. We wrote, of course, we communicated by writing letters in those days. So those were like my best friends. And I think Judy is the one that I kind of kept the best communication with. But at Nationals, I was, I think there was a little building somewhere in the middle of the track, and around behind that building, someone hit me in the stomach, and I was kind of passed out right before the finish line. But Pat and I were pretty far up ahead with that race. So I was allowed to run at Olympic Trials, and I was in the ninth lane of an eight-lane track. And I did. I was in the top three, so I got to go to the training camp. And that was a great experience for me, even though none of the three of us made the standard for Rome, so only Pat got to go. One of the other gals, coaches who was there, and she was often an official, Junior Ballou. And not too many people at that training camp trained. I think... Ed Temple had Wilma and a couple of his girls out there training, but the others really didn't train. So Juna spent a lot of time with me, and she taught me about intervals and different things. And even though I didn't make the team, just barely missed out by a second or less, when I went home, I went to Seattle Pacific University. Of course, there's no women's team there. But Ken Form, the coach who was there at that time said he didn't want to coach any girls, but if the guys didn't care, I could run with them. And they were happy, just like has been mentioned. I've always found that the most supportive people of women running are usually men who train hard and run in the same races and have really good respect. It's like runners, it's not if you're old or young or man or woman. It's like you have a great time together because you have it in common and you respect each other. So I had really good support from the guys. The only trouble was I tried to do everything they did, and more and harder aren't necessarily better. It's doing what's right for you, unless you want to be injured all the time. So for my college years, I didn't necessarily get much better. I just got a lot of stress fractures and whatnot. But Coach Ken Foreman came back to coach after getting his doctorate, and he was a well-educated coach. Scientifically and in every respect. And he also, like Will Stevens and a couple other coaches at that time, one from Frederick, Maryland, who were willing to put themselves out there outside of the good old boys club and really put themselves out for women. Ken was actually the first chairman of cross country and, didn't make himself too popular with the AAU, and he and Francis Kaczewski were not good friends at all. But, during the time, I guess it was 1967, actually, when I had the opportunity to do what kind of spurred me into being a better runner, have confidence in myself. My breakthrough race was an indoor mile in Canada. And, again, we're just out in the Northwest. We didn't have very many races. One year when I was in college, I only had two competitions the whole year. aside from a couple of high school boys' races. And I guess I was excommunicated from AAU, but nobody told me, so I didn't ever have a problem about it. This indoor mile in Canada was the first chance I ever had to run a mile. Before that, it was like 800 was the longest. So I'm still out running around in the woods, you know, doing long runs, seeing how far I could, how far over 10 miles I could go under an hour, those kind of goals. And in this race in Canada, we were told, you know, that Leather had the world record in the mile, and it was over 5 minutes indoors, and my time was 4:53, I think. So that was pretty exciting to win this indoor mile. Mm-hmm. And then it was a world record indoors, except indoors, I guess, not real world records. But anyway, that same year, that was in probably February, and then in March was the World Cross Country Championship, and the first time that women got to run in the World Cross Country Championship was in Wales, Barry, Wales. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the U.S. wasn't about to send a team, but they said that I could go if I wanted to pay my way and go. So my coach went as the U.S. coach, and there was one other girl from California, and we went to Barry, Wales. And winning that race was really exciting. And by then, I was out of school, and I was teaching and coaching. And besides my own running, one of the things that was really important to me, because I love to run so much, and I wanted to be able to help other girls to have opportunities to use their God-given abilities to enjoy running in ways that we weren't really having at that time. So winning that race wasn't only exciting for myself, but I thought this would be something that would help the U.S. powers that be to recognize us in distance races and, you know, maybe really even support sending a U.S. Team the next year. Well, we were allowed to have a team if we paid our own way and everything. So for the next, I won that race for 5 years in a row. And the team that we had at Seattle Pacific with Ken Foreman was a real good team because of his efforts and the university's willingness to have a club. So we, I think, had three of the six people from our club that were there. Trina Hosmer, who was a cross-country skier, who Sarah Berman knows well.
Who's that?
And Vicky Schultz. Trina Hosmer.
Who did you say?
Sarah, you knew Trina Hosmer, I think.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's still winning Masters races all over the world.
Yeah, she is.
In cross-country skiing.
In the World Championships in cross-country skiing for the last 5 years, I think she's won, like, five gold medals.
Yep.
Three gold medals and other medals. She's really... she didn't do well in the Winter Olympics that she went to in Japan because her ski broke. But since then, she's been top dog. And
she didn't do well because the coach was political, and he had counted on having junior age girls, and she was in her middle 20s. And therefore, one of his pets didn't make the team because she made the team. He was very unhappy with her.
Yeah. I don't even want to get into all that because we had another girl on the team, Patty Ingberg, who was in the same position.
That's a whole nother
one. And I was skiing as well as they were, but the thing was, if you're coaching and teaching, you can't do everything. So even my running took a back seat to my coaching and teaching. I was really more concerned about my athletes and about getting opportunities for women. So like I said, with the cross country, I really thought that would help, you know, that... winning.
What was
that
the first
race
year? Doris.
First year
was
1967.
67. And then you won the next four or five in a row.
I won the next four. And then
what was the distance?
Well, it's hard to say because in those days people weren't too concerned about the exact distance. And whenever the race was in Europe, if it was on the continent, they would like to have it very short. The fifth time I went in Spain, the race was probably like 2.5 miles, but the coaches rebelled. And at that point, the whole world wasn't too involved. You know, there weren't women all over the world running. It was mainly that English group. So the coaches rebelled, and they made the race a little longer. So it might have been 3 miles. But it was still too short, but it was certainly better than 400 meters and better than 800 meters.
Certainly was.
Anyway, So, and in that race, I could say, too, Trina Hosmer was in there. She's probably the only gal who was involved in the World Cross Country Ski Championship 1 week in Sweden, and the next week in Spain running World cross-country running championship. But, so I had some great friends, and I think we all could mention that probably one of the best things that we've gained from our running careers has been the friendships that we've developed.
Yep.
And we're lucky in our sport that, you know, like Lynn Jennings always said, honor your competitors with your best effort. And I think we did. We all wanted each other to be the best runners they could be. I've never, ever been in a situation where racing or having distance running friends weren't really good friends. And yet we were all in there for each other while we were trying to be the best. And I think that's not true of all other sports. And it's something I really cherish. But, I guess I just mentioned a couple of other my what I'd call my most meaningful experiences running. One of them would have been to qualify for the 800 meters in the 68 Olympics, because after being within a second of going in 1960, it took me a long time with all my stress fractures and all the rest, you know, to get back to being a decent runner on the track. And so I went to the Olympics there, got knocked out of my race, didn't have the race I'd hoped for. And but anyway, I made that goal. And then also I'd have to say that in 1984, to be the coach, the women's distance coach for the Olympics in L.A. was a real privilege for me.
Oh,
because
wow.
The marathon and the 3K and the 400 were added that year. And those are, you know, the 3K and the marathon were really what were dear to my heart. And so to be the coach for that event was a very special privilege. And, of course, Joan Bonnet winning didn't hurt either.
that was
awesome experience. Another thing that I'd want to mention that was really proud and humbling to me was to be inducted into the Distance Running Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Because I had chosen to go the track route, you know, as far as where I really put my emphasis. And, well, running the marathon, you know, would have been desirable. But I did run a couple of marathons. I was second in New York one time. And my best race was in Canada. And I think that was like 2:47. Yeah.
Wow.
And way back then, that was a good time. And it was a Canadian record fight by 10 minutes, and I had that record for a long time. But both these marathons were run at times when I couldn't really train for them because I had some important 800 thing to do, like, you know, right at that time. But since I was usually running over 100 miles a week anyway, I was in okay shape to run a marathon, probably just never to do the best I could have. So those were some of my highlights. And I guess what I'd really want to be remembered for the most would be because I really love to run. I think Hope, probably my gravestone will say she loved to run.
Yeah.
But some of the things, I don't know, I don't want to be a griper and I don't want to bring up negative things or negative names, but we all know the powers that be in the AAU aren't always in favor about even our sport, let alone just women. I think we don't have to mention too many names like Avery Brundage. But it seems like through the years, our biggest battle has never been against men. It's been against the powers that be. And I just like to tell you two little stories that I wish almost wouldn't be recorded, but they're the kind of things that you all know about, too. I would have gone, I didn't get to go to my sixth World Cross Country Championship because there was a meet against Russia. And the women's chairman said that I would be going to that. And in those days, you know, we would never think to sue or anything like that. We kind of did what we had to. So I went to that race. But in the meantime, we had put on the trials for that cross-country meet. And since I was kind of responsible for what was going on there, by the time I got everybody fed and through their workouts and into their travel uniforms and on the plane to go to England and race where I didn't get to run after winning the trials by probably over 200 meters, also while they were there, I had to take the orals for my master's degree, so they sat through that with me. Got them on the plane. This is the way things were in those days, you know, not quite as formal as it is these days for a national team. Then I got on the plane about 11 o'clock at night and went down to the the East Coast somewhere. I think it was
somewhere
Virginia.
On the East Coast.
And I ran my race, my track race, which actually was my best mile of my career, but I was third. But I was so disappointed not to get to go to England. So that was one story. The other one that I could tell was before the 84 Olympics that spring, I had never had my way paid anywhere. except I did get my way paid to that New York Marathon. They paid the cash when I got second. But anyway, I finally got an invitation to go to England and Ireland to run. And the man who was in charge over there had said, how come you don't even answer? Every year we send you an invitation to go race over here. We'll pay your way. We'll do everything. And you don't even have, you know, you're not even decent enough to respond. And I said, I've never heard about this. They said, well, we send it to your federation. So he would send it to me. So the night before, I'm all ready to go on this trip, really excited because I had never won any money. I'd never, you know, and here they're going to pay my way to go run over there. So night before, I get a call from, you can probably guess who, at the AAU. And said,
does it begin with A?
You will not be able to run as an amateur anymore. And you haven't applied to us to take a chaperone, and there were a lot of other things. So I said, okay, I won't take the money. What if I go to the bank, borrow the money, and go on my own? Okay, you can do that. So it took me an extra day to borrow the money. It took me 5 years to pay it back. Went over there, ran some good races, even won the high jump in Scotland in the cow pasture. Got a set of Hungarian dishes for that. And went on to Crystal Palace and ran my best 800 I ever ran, although I was third. But and all this time, people are they want to give me handfuls of money. And I said, no, can't take it. I got to stay amateur, you know, because I was terrified about not being able to go to the Olympics. And so that's the kind of story that I think was pretty common to a lot of us in those days.
Yeah.
I won't go through any more of
this. Yeah, the AAU had such power and such control.
And I think I wouldn't just say that was the only woman, but I think we took the worst brunt of it. Also, some of the other things that I had opportunity to do that kind of interfered with my own running, but because I really felt like it was important for us, along with Judy and I know others, that we would try to make things better for those who came after us, give them the opportunity to enjoy their God-given talents. I had the chance, because I coached at a school that had NAI men and AIW women, and because I was young enough and I was an amateur and I was in the top few, I could be on an AAU committee and represent a whole lot of different groups. So I was able to worm my way into places where I could be able to represent women's sports, and, you know, along with Jacqueline Hansen and Joan Ulliott and the rest of us pushing for the longer races. I went ahead and did all these things I could. I was a women's cross-country chairman. I was on the LDR committee and did everything I could at the convention and did everything I could at the AIW level and at the NC2A and at the NAIA. All these areas where there was opportunity to speak for our sport and to be involved. And through this time, I also was one of the two people with Russ Hodge who got the Athletes Advisory Council moving on in AAU. And I was the athlete representative for on the USLC for track and field. And at that time, we had some real special opportunities with dealing with Title IX and also with the Senate hearings, the congressional hearings, about sport, amateur sport. So this gave me a little chance to speak up for what we were trying to do with women's distance running. It didn't help my own career too much because I didn't want to miss school or coaching, so I'd always be flying around in the middle of the night between classes and whatnot. But this seemed important to me. I mean, it still is. I think my greatest joys have really been when my athletes have broken my records and made teams that I didn't get to do go on and things like that. I think all of you know what I mean about the joy of seeing people come and if you can help them to do things that you didn't get to do.
Yeah.
So
just think what would have happened if there had been the internet in those days and we could have gotten together by internet and pooled our forces.
We would have probably been much better acquainted.
These are beautiful stories.
I think the county deal and all this, maybe if I was to say what I would be remembered for on these committee things, besides the Olympic Committee, athletes one, would be being the first woman on the IAAF Cross Country and Road Race Committee. And again, it started out kind of like most things for women, you know. The first few meetings, I got the notice about a month after the meeting. But eventually, everything started to work out pretty well. Turned out there were a couple men on that committee who I had actually run with in cross country in the early days. So that I think I felt like they were very accepting, just like male runners. The men on that committee were very, very cordial to women. And I think that that committee actually was more cordial to us than the women's committee.
Yes.
At that
time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they had a woman there who was a little bit like some other woman we know who wasn't that helpful to us.
Was Pat? Was that Pat Rico from New York?
Yeah. And also with that, I feel like what really happened was I've always tried to be a good example and a good role model and think about, you know, the impression that I would make as far as not causing any damage, you know, to be a good role model. And I think it paid off because then after me, there were several women who held that position, and now, you know, there's pretty much equal representation on those committees with men and women. But I have to say it was hard for me to get elected after that first time because the powers that be in the United States actually nominated another person, and it was the European men on that committee who got me reelected. So I again have to speak up for male contingencies who are always been supportive of us, and I hope that we never, you know, we never fail to let that be known because there was some support for us there that probably people don't know about.
Yeah.
So,
Doris, these are great stories. We have two more presenters, so I want to get Judy and Arlene.
Okay,
and
you're in trouble
for going on so long.
Well, these are tremendous stories, and appreciate hearing all these. Judy, you know, I look at your resume. Your resume reminds me of my father's career of being a quarter mile and a half mile in college, and then going on to be a national marathon and 50 mile champion.
Yeah, just go on and watch.
Judy,
how old are you now?
I'm 72. Me and Doris and a whole bunch
Julia.
Of
us.
Well, I'm 72.
Yeah.
I'm 74. This is Joan.
Oh, my God, you're old.
The reason I asked is I'm 78, and the only person who's older than me here is Krista.
Chris is
older. Chris,
by the way, this is Chris McKenzie. I'm going to be 84 in a couple of weeks' time.
You
did,
of course.
Okay. Well, I wanted to start out by thanking you so much, Gary, for having us all. My gosh, I am the worst letter writer in the world, and to just talk to all these people and hear what they've been doing and have done, it's just really exciting. So, yeah, I started running when I was 13 because somebody in my high school, I went to a high school with asthmatics, and everybody was sickly, and this girl, Karen, her mother had been an athlete in Germany, and she thought if Karen did athletics that Karen would become stronger and breathe better. And at that time, we're talking 1954, there were probably in California maybe 30 or 40 women that ran track and field. That was it, you know. All ages, everything. There was nothing in the high schools, nothing in the colleges. But in Southern California, Stella Walsh would hold four track meets during the spring so people could practice. Nobody practiced year-round, but they held four track meets in the spring so that people could get ready for the national championships. And in order to make it seem more like a track meet, everybody who came had to compete in every event. So there was the 50, the 100, the 220, the high jump, the broad jump, the javelin, the discus, the shot put, and the 70-meter low hurdles.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a real tomboy, but I was kind of hesitant about going to a track meet for women. And Karen said, no, you got to come. There's this woman there who's not exactly a woman. She's sort of like half man and half woman. Say that to a 13-year-old who knows nothing, and you know I was there. So
So we went out there, and the only person I managed to beat all day was Karen, because everybody else was a national champion. And I just loved it. It was so much fun. And then the next year, they decided they were going to put the International Olympic Committee put the 800 meters in the 1960 Olympics. And so Stella had to put the 800 meters at the track meet, and nobody wanted to run it. So it was me and Stella out there. And Stella said, okay, whoever wins the first lap wins a quarter, and whoever wins the second lap then wins 800. So I would go out there and run 64.98. She would come trotting by me the last 10 yards. And my mother, who was my greatest supporter and my best friend, who had been so involved in track and field that she was the meet director for the 1961 National Championships at the Coliseum in L.A. But my mother said, you know, you're going to need a coach if you're going to continue to do this. And she talked to a friend of hers who had a son in college. And he said, well, my roommate, he'd be interested in coaching a girl. And that was Dennis.
Aww.
So when I was 16, Dennis came out and started coaching me. And there were no books on track and field. There was no Runner's World. There was no my mother had found some books on distance swimming that were written in German. But they had the chart with all the workouts. And so he would have me do those workouts. And he, of course, coached me my whole life, and then went on to college. And then in 1967, the Las Vegas decided they wanted to put on a marathon, and they were sponsored by the local newspaper. And the publisher of the local newspaper thought if they had some women running in that race, it would put out a lot of buzz for it. So he looked around, and he noticed that our club, which was the Pasadena Athletic Association, had some women who ran distances. And he called Dennis and he said, if you guys will come to Las Vegas, we will put you up in a hotel. We'll give you $20 a day per diem and you can run this marathon. You can't have a number. You can't be officially entered, but we will do this for you. So Lynn Carmen and Bob and Dennis and I got in Dennis's Volkswagen Bug and drove to Las Vegas. And, oh, my God, we thought we were millionaires. They put us up in this hotel, and they gave us $20 a day for me and Lynn. We ate high on the hog, and then we ran this marathon. Dang, that was fun. But we were track athletes, you know. We weren't going to really do it. I didn't run another one then until 73. And I don't know why we decided to run then. But I think we ran down, and Bill Guggen was putting on a race in San Diego, the San Diego Marathon, and we ran down there. And the hook was that whoever won and broke 3 hours got a Seiko wristwatch.
Oh.
Oh, my God. I ran 3 hours and 7 seconds. He wouldn't give me the watch.
Oh, that meanie.
What? So the next year we aimed for it. And we went out there, and I remember there were probably 8 women running or something like that. And I remember coming up on this lady at mile 16 or 17 and going, wow, aren't we doing well? We're running really well here. We're just having a great time. And I went on and on and on, and finally I paused for breath, and she looked at me and she said very clearly, I do not speak English.
Who was that, Judy?
Oh, yeah. And I ran 2:54.26 or something like that.
You did 2:54.
But they didn't give watches that year. So,
yeah.
But then in March, they had the national championships. We're up north here in San Mateo. And it was 2 weeks before Boston or something like that. So all the women who were really talented were going to Boston. But we couldn't afford it because we had 3 little kids by that time. And Grandma and Grandpa came in. Babysat the kids, and we went up there, and I won the nationals. That was really a good.
That was the first national marathon championship for women.
The very first national for women. Yeah, and that was in San Mateo, California. And then they had an international
national championship.
Yes.
And what year was that?
1974.
And then they
Joan,
had an
were you in there?
I was there.
Yes, yep. And that was I was second.
Yeah.
Was that the one where
who
started at Half Moon Bay and went over to Belmont?
No.
No.
One that was a longer race. Who's
oh, I did do San Mateo, though. I was think I was fourth.
Who was thinking?
It had four laps of the
Donna.
Of this track.
Yeah, four laps in Burlingame.
Yeah, in
yes,
Burlingame.
Yes, I did it.
And there was this drunk woman who came out of her house and sat in a chair, and as we all went by, she went, "Whoa, women, go women!"
Yeah.
And
yes,
I remember
finishing, I remember it.
And I said, "Where did I finish?" I said, first. I said, no, where did I actually finish in the race? Because women didn't count, you know. It was the national.
Right.
It was the national championship. It was very important.
And then they had
a woman's national championship?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
First women's. Up to that point, women and men did not. The men's championships were always in some high-profile place like New York or something. The women's championships were wherever they could find cheap whatever, you know. And I remember the 1960 Olympic trials and nationals in Corpus Christi and Abilene with Doris. My mother drove us there from Southern California in the car, me and her and Dennis and my two brothers. And the University of Corpus Christi did not understand when they bid for the national championship that there would be women there who were not white. And they were horrified. They didn't want them to stay in the dorm. So on the campus, they had these housing that they'd used during World War II that had been closed ever since, and they opened it up and put us there. And there were no screens on the window, and it was horribly humid, and the water didn't work properly. And my mother, who was a radical from radical heaven, would go every day and get a list from all these kids from Tennessee of what they could eat and what they wanted, and she would go into town and buy food for everybody because
nice.
The stuff they were feeding us was inedible. And my mother was furious. And so she wrote a petition to the AAU stating this is no way to treat the women who are going to represent our country at the Olympics. And a bunch of people signed it, mainly the long-distance runners, and she presented it to them. And they were so pissed that when we got to the Olympic trials in Abilene the next week, they had three heats for the 800 meters the night before. They put everybody who had signed that petition in the first heat. We both broke. Everybody in that heat broke the national record by 4 seconds, and the other two heats like 6 and 10 seconds over the national record. But so they sent us 1-2 in that first heat, and then all the rest of those girls who were very upset didn't make it to the final. So I think one more they had, but Dennis was coaching. I think the thing we'd like to be remembered for is our work with the Roadrunners. They had a local elementary school teacher down here who was running around after school with his fourth and fifth graders to lose weight. And then when it came to be spring, all the boys went off to play Little League softball, and he was left with all these girls, and he didn't know what to do with them. So there had been an article in the paper about me or something, so he called me. And he said, "I need a coach." And I said, "I volunteer my coach." So Dennis went and he coached. He coached also when he was in graduate school in physics. He coached the high school at UC Riverside. He coached the track team and the cross country team. But he coached for like 20, 25 years. He never took a penny for it because that would have jeopardized his amateur status. So, but he coached the Roadrunners, and over the years.
Your husband?
Yep. Dennis
is still alive?
Yeah.
No,
Dennis passed away a year. So.
Oh.
But we had, you know what? We had 48 good married years, and we had 54 years together. And in that time, the longest time we were ever separated was the 17 days I was at the Maccabee Games in 1961. So, you know. And he got his PhD in physics when he was 25, and he taught physics and then computer science at Cal State San Bernardino for 35 years. And then we started this business, Timing Races, which is where I am right now. And now we time about 75 events a year We time 40% of the largest half marathons. We time, we have tons of computers. We have.
This is Race Central, is your company?
This is Race Central. It's my, yeah. When my kids were going on becoming teenagers, he said, you need a job. You can't stay home anymore. He was wonderful. And the local newspaper down here wanted to put on a run, and I thought that would be a good way for us to give back. And he wanted to buy a computer, and we developed some pretty good systems. But now that it's, you know, chip timing, it's completely. But it's, and my friends and foes are all the same that everybody else's have. Yeah, all those same people. Yeah, Dennis tried early on. I don't know how he got back to one of those AAU national meetings, but he tried to go back and do it, and then he came back and he said, "You know what? Politics is not my thing." it was a shame that it got so political, because that, you know, running, people do running because they love it. And although nowadays the people who do running, there are, and now I've always been interested in statistics. More than half of the runners in the half marathons we time are women.
Wow!
Yeah,
and
it's amazing, isn't it, Judy?
I just look at those people and I think, I have no idea.
Yes,
yeah.
Right.
And
keep our rights,
course,
boy.
And it's amazing the way running has narrowed down to 5Ks, 10Ks, half marathons, and marathons. Because when we were running, you laid out a course, and whatever it came out to be, it was the Pop Marty 9.6.
Yeah.
Five or whatever, you know. It was just, but nowadays people think they have to run, you know, 5K or a 10K or something.
Yeah.
We don't.
Judy,
yeah, and the questions now have to be fast and flat, whatever, to get a good time. Then we didn't care about time. It was having a fun course.
We were just having fun, yeah. We had the Redlands community, which is a really nice little community down, has these hills right around it. And so they used to run this during the summer, they would run these all-comers cross-country meets. And after you'd run once, you got a handicap. So the first time you ran, you had to start scratch. And then the next time you ran, you got that many minutes in front of whatever the person who'd won was.
Mm-hmm.
So the first week, so we ran up this, and it went up the side on this fire trail. And then you were supposed to get to where the firemen had the locked gate and then turn around and come back down. Well, unbeknownst to me, because I was guarding scratch and I was the only one that day, I'm running up this fire trail, and a truck passed me. And it didn't occur to me for a long while that they probably opened the gate when they came through. So I'm running up this hill, and I'm running up and running up, and I don't see anybody. And I finally decide I've run up far enough, I should turn around, and I go, dang, I am going to win this race next week. I'm going to get a handicap like you wouldn't believe. Yeah.
Thank you. Let's have Arlene talk some about her recollections and her days of running.
Yes, we could all go on for hours. Sorry.
Right. I've got to quit.
These are great stories. Arlene?
Yes, I'm here.
Tell us about yourself and your recollections and memories.
Okay. I first want to say I've enjoyed meeting you girls and ladies, and all the accomplishments you have done, and their stories are just fantastic.
Yes.
Arlene, how old are you?
84.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my gosh.
And I feel so honored that he invited me to be part of this so I could meet you. It's just amazing to me. Because my world, I'll make it brief, but my world was health and exercise as a teenager. That's when it started. My boyfriend was working out with weights between his mother's stove and kitchen. She was all upset about it, so he brought him over and put him in my backyard. So we had a flat bench and barbells and dumbbells,
and that's where I started exercising and working out. And I still do to this day, but very briefly because I've had 3 hip surgeries, so I'm walking with a walker and a wheelchair and all that kind of stuff. But the rest of my body's great, and my mind is great, and I still have a lot of things I want to do in life. But so health and exercise was our thing. My husband and I, we worked for health studios, Harold Zink and Inferno, and owned our own health studio. Then we were had an opportunity to go to Colorado Springs, Colorado, and take over a health studio that was there. So we packed up our 3 kids and went to Colorado. And we opened the first woman's health studio ever, and very first one. And one day my husband says, well, why don't you run the Pikes Peak Marathon and advertise our health studio? Well, I had never done running, you know. So he had friends that were track stars and stuff, so they trained me for, it was probably 6-7 months of training, running 10 miles around the football field a few times a week. Then on weekends, we'd pack up the 3 children who were 9, 7, and 4, and a picnic lunch, and we'd go a few miles up, and we'd park them by, they called it No Name Creek, and with their picnic lunch, and we'd go halfway up the mountain every Sunday. And then I only went to the top once, and that was probably a couple weeks before the race, and I looked down and I said, oh, wow. You know, the last 2.5 or so miles is nothing but rocks, and there's a very small narrow path between the rocks. Mm-hmm. And they took my picture at the top, which I still have, and give to people and all that kind of stuff. But it's back then, as you recall, we wore short, tight white shorts and tied our blouses in a knot. And that's what I had on that day. And I just want one comment I want to make. You guys talked a lot about how our lives were back in the 50s and early 60s. A sentence I always like to say is, back then, we were supposed to stay home, bake cookies, and have babies. And that's
right.
All we were allowed. Mm-hmm. That's all we were allowed to do.
That's so right.
So anyway, I did the race, and if you want to know more about the race and the Pikes Peak things, if you went on your computer and go to Pikes Peak Marathon or Arlene Piper, there's just stories and pictures and all kinds of stuff about the marathon. And I didn't know I was the first woman till 6 years ago. The Pikes Peak Marathon people were celebrating 50 years of women running the Pikes Peak Marathon. It took them 4 years to find me. Finally, one lady did find me, and because I had been married a few times and moved and all this kind of stuff. So now they brought my daughter was 9. She went to the top. I was 29 and went to the top, waved to the crowd, and went down. Neither one of us did a lot of running. It was because it was uphill and down little dales and lots of rocks and twigs and all kinds of stuff, you know. But so they bring us back every, this is me the 5th year in August, they bring my daughter and I back, and they just like 2 queens for a week.
Oh, nice.
And, nowadays, there's so many things for running, and as you people know, the drinks, the food, the clothes, the shoes, you know. Back then, when we ran, there was 15 men and another lady, my daughter, and myself. That's all that ran the race that day.
Oh, my gosh.
We bought our shoes at we bought our tennis shoes at the dime store, and we got a drink of water out of the stream. That was how we ran the race. And nowadays, they've got every couple of miles, there's a station for water and first aid. And they go so far, and they feel they're not going to make it. They make them turn around and go back. They don't want people, because there's thousands of people that do this. They have a half marathon on Saturday and the whole marathon on Sunday. And they let me start the race, which I'm so honored to do, and they let me pass out the trophies. And I just, just a wonderful, wonderful experience for me. And even the men, not just the women, say that I was their inspiration. They figured if I could do it, they could do it. You know?
Good for you.
So, but you guys,
the things that you people have done are just amazing. It's just fantastic what you guys have done, and the running you've done, and the life that you've had with it. And I remember back you're saying one phrase, someone said that whatever shape your body's in at 30, that's what you're going to be when you get older. And I feel that's why my body is still good, except for the fact that I took one of those products that was supposed to make your bones stronger.
Oh.
And I did for a year and a half. And then they announced on the TV, yes, this does make your bones stronger, but they're brittle. So when I did fall, it was 1980 when was my first surgery. When I did fall, I saw the ball, and it was even crushed to smithereens. I mean, so if I hadn't taken that stuff,
Tana,
that my doctor
what was it called?
I think it was Boniva.
There
were two of them, and you took a pill once a month, and then you stood up for 30 minutes. You didn't ever lay down,
That was the
Boniva. It probably made them stronger. See, then they were brittle, and then as I got older, I slipped and fell on forgot what, and it just smashed it. And then the first hospital didn't do it right, so 6 months later I had to do it over. And then the next year I fell again and broke the other one. But I still work out and I walk a lot, and my daughter and I like to go to the marathon races. There was one here in Modesto, which is not far from Fresno, and just be part of their thing. Those marathon runners are so honored to meet me, and I have so much fun with this.
Nice.
Famous. It's just such an honor to meet, and to meet all you ladies that have done so much with marathon running and all kinds of sports.
I think we're glad that you're
Gary, can
to
I ask a question to Sarah May?
Some
of us are getting older. I find that my health service, my husband and I are in fairly good shape. They don't know how to figure out how to prescribe things to me, how to limit my activities if they think I'm limited, because they're thinking of a person who's my age in the late 70s as someone who's fragile and delicate and maybe doesn't have good balance. And it's silly. They just don't know. So not only do they don't know how to treat women, they don't know how to treat women and even men who have been athletic all their lives.
Especially with their hearts and things, too.
This is Joan chiming in here. I'm a doctor, as most of you
know.
Yes,
Joan.
And,
yes, Joan.
You're absolutely right. They don't know how to treat people who are active and older.
Yeah, Adam,
I think it's good. I have to admit that I've been running only about 43 years now, something like
42
years.
You're right.
But my knees and my hips are fine.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Great.
Maybe because I didn't run all those years when I was little, but they are fine, and I think it's the impact that I continue to have. I think it's very important to continue putting stress on those joints so that you keep your cartilage built up.
The last surgeon that did one of my hip surgeries, he said, walk a lot every day. And I said, how much? He said, a lot. And keep stretching. And I mean, I stretch and I work out and I walk at least 30 minutes every day, sometimes twice a day. And do as much. Keep move it or lose it is another one of my favorite sayings.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
I've tried to get most of my friends, my three dearest friends have passed away. I could never get them to even walk around the block, much less do anything. You know, you've got to just like you ladies are just keeping going, and this you're going to live a long life. Somebody said they wanted to be 120. Well, yeah. I would like to make it to 100. That's my goal.
Yeah.
And still be able to do things. You know, but it's and a lot of what you do and I have with done is in our mind. If your mind says yes, you can do it. That's why you guys have run so far and done so many
wonderful races and won them. But I think your goal, too, when you run these races, is not necessarily you want to win. You just want to do your best.
Yes.
And maybe go faster than you did the last time. But winning is not the most important thing in all the running that you
ladies have fun.
Yeah. Right.
Could I
I'd run up Mount Washington once in like 69. It's one hill, you understand. It's 7.6 miles. It's 6,000 feet at the top. It's not straight up, but there's a fellow who's written a book about the Mount Washington races because it's a tradition, and he couldn't find my name in any of the results, and I finally figured out why. I wasn't running officially.
Yeah,
oh, wow. You couldn't register, yeah.
This has happened, I think, probably to many women and their results. If they were running in longer races than the AAU allowed, they were not running officially, and so their times weren't taken officially.
I really don't know how myself and another lady, my daughter, got to run in this, because I wanted to run the Boston Marathon, but back, of course, they wouldn't let me.
No.
You know, women weren't supposed to do anything.
This is Julia. Can I tell a funny story?
Hello, Arlene. Could I
ask
your age, please? I'm sorry. I've got great big fingers, and I keep touching this doobad fit machine. I'm not one of these up with everything. I'm sorry. Can you tell me how old you are, Arlene?
I'm 84.
We're twins practically, huh?
Yeah.
I was 84 in March, so I'm one of the older ladies in this little group here.
One sister in the room.
And I'm next year. I'm 84 in July.
Yeah, see? And we're still driving, still doing the things we want to do to the best of our ability. A little slower, our minds are everything's a little slower, but we're still going and jamming, right?
Well, as long as I'm breathing, I'd like to feel... Well, I still see people run by my house, and I feel like 21. I want to go after them again. But my legs also stop me. But I've coached in Great Neck for over 30 years now, and Gordon and I both coach all kinds of youth teams in Great Neck. And it seems like an alternative ago. I keep telling the kids, don't forget, nobody's got four arms and four legs. They can do it. You can do it. And that's what I feel about me. I suppose we're lucky to be alive and be able to talk and thank God.
Yeah, I agree with that. I found that I'm now just taking twice as long for everything I do. Like a 10K instead of 32 is like a 64. But
that's a good time.
As long as I can get
to be able to do it. You know, to be out there enjoying it.
As long as I hear Frank Sinatra, I'm on the go.
Can I tell a funny story?
Our music is the best, too, isn't it?
Yep.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You wanted to tell a funny story?
I did.
Especially Sammy Davis.
I want to hear the funny story. Wait.
Just a quick story. I ran Manchester in 1961, and 50 years later, I decided, hey, I can still fit into my Smith gym suit. I'm going to run the 50th anniversary. And wouldn't you know it, the year before, I developed prolapsing uterus. And I thought about it, and I said, nope, I have to have the surgery. There's no way I'm going to, 50 years later, run down the main street of Manchester and drop my uterus. It'll set us back.
But as long as I can hear Sammy Frick Davis Jr. sing, did it my way. That's the best thing I know.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Boy.
Before we hang up, I want to know how we're going to get together again.
Facebook.
Yeah.
Judy and I are on Facebook. I don't know about the rest of you.
Is Gary
on
here?
Facebook? Do we have emails for all of us?
Well, let me end the taping of this, and then we can talk some more. But this has been tremendous. These stories, and we'll find ways to keep in touch and keep this going. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hold
on. Gary.
Hold on.
We had email addresses or something.
That's Joan.
Nope.
Gary, I did want to...